Okay. We are going to call the April 21st meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature to order. Please, if you're able to stand, rise, and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you all. Our clerk will be right back for roll call of members. Mike Sigler?
You're muted, Mike.
Here.
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 Amanda Champion?
Here.
Deborah Dawson?
Here.
Henry Grandison?
Present. I would say that I'm here.
Rich John?
Here.
Anna Kellis will be joining us in a minute. Dan Fine?
Here.
Ann Foreman?
Present. I can't figure out my video, but I'm going to work on it.
Mike Lane?
Here.
Dave McKenna? Glenn Morey?
Here.
Martha Robertson?
Here.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Present.
12 members present.
Thank you very much. Good to see all of you. Presentation, proclamations, petitions, communications?
Communications are on sent via email.
Communications were sent via email. So you should have those. Let's go to, are there any executive sessions for this evening? Jason, are you with us? Rick?
Yes, I'm right here. Nothing.
Is there a need for an executive session?
I have nothing for you, no.
No? Any legislators? No? Very
there
well.
There is a proclamation.
Very well. Thank you very much. Yes. We do have a proclamation we'll get to. Let me go ahead and read this proclamation. So the proclamation reads, whereas the first Earth Day was celebrated on the streets of hundreds of American cities and college campuses on April 22, 1970, to launch our country's grassroots environmental protection movement. And whereas that first Earth Day prompted unprecedented federal legislation to protect our planet's environment, including the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the numerous federal programs that it enforces. And whereas the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation was created by legislation symbolically signed by Governor Nelson Rockefeller on April 22, 1970, and whereas on April 22, 2020, America and countries around the world will observe a 50th annual Earth Day celebration, and whereas in the current state of New York pause, our local Earth Day celebration will be a virtual one and will be live streamed on the Get Your Green Back Tompkins Facebook page beginning at 2 p.m. on April 22nd. And whereas the environmental challenges we face this year on the 50th Earth Day are more threatening and urgent than ever due to the progress of anthropogenic climate change, and whereas the designated theme of this 50th Earth Day is climate action, and whereas New York State has committed itself to mitigating the effects of climate change by passage of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, and whereas Tompkins County as a certified silver climate smart community recognizes the urgent need to mitigate the impact of climate change and has committed itself to positive climate action by adopting an updated energy strategy and forming a climate and sustainable energy advisory board. And whereas the Tompkins County Legislature believes that even as we pause to prevent the spread of COVID-19 virus, we should use the opportunity presented by this 50th Earth Day to renew our individual and community commitment to protecting our environment and mitigating the impacts of anthropogenic climate change. Now, therefore, I, Leslyn McBean Claiborne, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim April 22nd, 2020 as Climate Action Earth Day in Tompkins County, signed on this 21st day of April 2020. So presented, and thank you to Legislator Deborah Dawson for crafting this proclamation, presented to the citizens of Tompkins County to celebrate and honor the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
So I just spoke with Anna Kellis. She's having technical difficulties, but Dave McKenna just joined us. So.
Okay.
13 members.
Dave has joined us. Anna will be joining us as soon as she gets her technical difficulties worked out. We understand that these things happen when we're going with technology. So moving on to privilege of the floor for the public. Did we receive anything from public? I did not receive anything. Any other legislators received anything from the public? No? Thank you. Recognizing our municipal officials, we're so thrilled that they can join us today, and I will call you in order as we received your notice that you will be with us, starting with Beth McGee from the town of Enfield. Beth, are you still with us?
Yep, there you are. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Madam Chairwoman. And I appreciate the invite to come and let you know what's happening in Enfield. So the Enfield community, I think, has done really well coming together in this crisis. One of our biggest needs right now has been food security, and our food pantry has a great reputation as being one that provides choice. When I had initially expressed concern about having people coming to the food pantry and being in line together and waiting for food, they got right on that and adapted their plans within a week and had a whole online ordering system set up so we could still utilize choice for food collection and receipt of food. And the quality of the food that they're getting is really terrific, and people are volunteering to come and put boxes together for them. And then they have a process where people come and they pull up, and volunteers will bring boxes to the car. And then once the volunteers move away, then the people can get out of their car and pick up the boxes of food and put them in the car. So I think that it's going very smoothly. It is a ton of work. This takes about 4 days now of volunteers rather than 2 days of volunteers. So I'm really, really pleased by their ability and their commitment to responding to community needs in the crisis. They have really set a high bar for the rest of us, so I appreciate them. Emergency services have received the PPE from the county that they've needed, and they've been on standby waiting to respond as necessary. necessary. I will also add the food pantry is now using masks, and we've also gotten hand sanitizer for them from DOOR, so that was very much appreciated. Since the executive order was initiated, I've been working with my deputy town supervisor, Stephanie Redmond, to develop our virtual meeting process, and we've been facilitating the meetings that way since April 1st. We've been meeting weekly, and I guess we'll determine if we're going to continue to do that throughout May. We've had really good attendance. We've had 20 to 30 people attending each time, so that's been really great. We've had good participation from the public. We went ahead and did our audit presentation for an outside audit a couple weeks ago, and we're going to have our aquifer study presentation in May using Zoom. So the board has implemented hiring and purchasing freezes to some extent. The purchasing freeze isn't really set at a low threshold, but going forward, it may make sense for us to revisit that depending upon the budget. I am in communication with a state DOT about CHIPS funding, and there's, of course, I'm sure everybody knows there's a lot of confusion about when those notices are going to come out, what that funding might look like. While they might say that we're going to get that, they've also suggested that they would reevaluate the budget a couple times a year. So we're trying to plan accordingly. Our clerk is providing services remotely. She's utilizing the notary by video allowances and also issuing permits and licenses as needed, and she's assisting us with meeting notifications. The Highway Department has been working minimal hours on essential services and building maintenance as determined by the Highway Superintendent. The Town Board implemented partial unemployment beginning today. We can utilize that funding rather than relying upon possible reimbursement from COVID when this is over, and because right now the $600 additional benefit is in place weekly, and employees only have to have 1 hour of unemployment to qualify for that. So this benefit's in place through July 31st, unless it's extended, so we've opted to utilize the benefit until operations move back into full time. This process allows them to operate on minimal hours still, and so they can be safe and have less exposure without losing pay. The Town Board has elected to maintain employee health insurance at this time, so they have the benefits they need, and we also provide paid family leave at no cost for our employees, so they'll have that added benefit in the event that a family member becomes ill from COVID. So I just want to say that I've really valued the weekly calls with Jason and Frank, as well as Tom Reed, and I really appreciate how well that our local government reps and legislators have put aside our normal political differences with Tom, and we've communicated our needs effectively and cooperatively, and I do think that he understands the issues that impact us based on his experience as a mayor, and that he intends to be a strong voice for us, and I hope that we continue to communicate with him in the way that we have been. I would like to have more information on mental health services and answers to questions collected from people in the community that were offered earlier this month. It's great that the website for TC Mental Health and the Health Department have been updated. I'm wondering if the Mental Health Subcommittee is still meeting and if the recordings of those meetings could be put online with the minutes so people can participate after the fact, since it's an arm of the legislature. So it would be great if we could have those recordings put online so we have public access. And I just want to thank you all for hanging in there, because we really need your support in all of this, and it makes it possible for us to try to have some normalcy in local government operations. So I really want to thank you all for that and for this opportunity.
Thank you so very much, Beth, Town of Enfield Supervisor. And thank you all for all that you're doing as well, because this has been quite the ride for all of us. Any questions for Beth? Shauna?
I just wanted to answer your question Beth on the mental health subcommittee. That has not met since February, and we are just starting to have conversations on restarting some of the advisory boards. So whenever those restart, I'm sure we will probably do something similar to this Zoom meeting, and we will allow public access for that.
Thank you, Shauna.
Thank you.
Annie?
Thank you. Beth, thank you for the thorough presentation. And I also wanted to thank you and the town board for the balanced conversation that you had regarding the highway department staff and, you know, trying to balance the fiscal responsibilities for the town with the financial needs of the employees. So I really want to thank you for that. And a question I had was, how's the food pantry doing with volunteers?
Well, I think that they have about 30 volunteers that are helping them with boxing food, and then they have one service. And I apologize, I'm not remembering the name right now, but it's a local business that is providing delivery. So it's like a one-shot deal that they're doing the deliveries for us. So I think that volunteerism is going okay. They seem to have a lot of people. I know that Joanna is from time to time sending out notices if they need someone, but I am regularly connecting with Jean, and I'd be happy to ask her that and let people know, you know, further how they can volunteer. So.
Okay. And the amount of food and coordination, because I know they've 50% or 100% increased in the number of residents you're serving, is that correct?
I think the last number that I heard was 400 families this week, and that's up about double. So, yeah, it's a lot. I mean, people are out of work. I mean, in the first week or two, it increased up to 300. So that is a lot of people, and they're still providing a lot of food. So, I mean, I'm really impressed with the connections that they've made and the ability that they've had to keep stock on hand. So,
well, I think I can, if the legislature doesn't mind, I think I can speak for us all that we're really impressed with all that you guys are doing there. So thank you.
Thank you. And I really appreciate your comments about our conversation, because at times it did not feel very balanced. It felt, you know, a little difficult, of course. And, you know, it's the idea of any kind of unemployment is challenging for people to accept. And we just really felt like this was advantageous for our employees, for safety, for compensation. And right now was the time for us to utilize it, because if they don't extend the extra benefit, it's not helpful to employees. And we don't want to consider laying off like right now, you know, if we are looking at our budget. So we opted to take this this position.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you again, Beth. Thank you, Annie. Any other questions for Supervisor McGee? Are you raising your hand, Anna? Okay, acknowledging that you've joined us. All right.
I was just saying,
I also
fought the tech battle and finally won.
Okay. All right. I also want to acknowledge, since he's not in the little screen there that I can see, that in chambers with me is Dan, legislature, Dan Klein. There you are. Thank you. Town of Ithaca Supervisor Rod Howe, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. So I just want to add my thank you to what the county is doing. We've appreciated the leadership. I've also appreciated the weekly calls. So thank you very much for your leadership there. My plan is to give just a brief COVID-19 update, but then maybe mention a few other things that we're working on, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
So we, like every other municipality, are looking at the budget implications, both from a revenue and expenditure side. Our finance manager has made a presentation to our budget committee and to the town board. You know, so obviously it's a changing picture right now. We're making some guesses, but we're prepared to make decisions, probably especially about some major public works projects that we were expecting to do this year if we have to delay them a bit. So we, like everyone else, are knowing that there will be budget implications. We did not close our trails, but we did close our playgrounds. Our West Hill Community Garden, we temporarily closed, but we're starting to put together some policies so we can safely let folks garden at the West Hill Community Garden. We obviously significantly reduced the number of staff coming into both the Public Works facility and to Town Hall, well below the 50%. So now we're slowly ramping up. Our Public Works facility staff started coming back in very small teams this week. So, for instance, they're doing the brush pickup that would normally happen at this time of year. And we're just starting to work with department heads to bring some staff back at Town Hall. But, again, we'll stay below that 50% threshold. You know, I think we're all kind of amazed how much we're able to do with our normal business and operations, with people sort of scattered at different sites. So we're pleased that there's some basic services that we're still able to move forward on, and certainly anticipate that there might be some things that we do differently in the future based on this experience. We're doing Zoom meetings just like everyone else for committees and town board members. I think we figured out the public hearing piece. So I think that's it on COVID-19. I'll just go through the other things quickly and then open it up for questions about anything. We are moving forward with our Public Works facility renovation. It's a fairly major renovation, so it's basically started. And there, even when we do reopen our facilities to the public again, there will be some disruptions at the Public Works facility for several months. It's a pretty major renovation. We are working on a Green New Deal. So the town board passed a Green New Deal resolution about a month ago, which just means now the real work starts to create a Green New Deal action plan. We would like to partner with the city as much as possible on that. At the TCOG level, there is a new energy climate change subcommittee. So I certainly we want to mesh with whatever that group decides to work on. I don't have any details because we're just starting the process of developing a Green New Deal action plan that we're very excited about. We've had some discussions about the Community Housing Fund, the Tompkins County Community Housing Fund. Martha came and made a presentation to the board, and then we followed up with her and David West, Bill Goodman, and I to ask some additional questions. So the budget committee will certainly be talking about that as a possibility as part of our 2021 budget. So, Martha, thank you for the info you've provided on that. The Inlet Valley, we have been focusing on what some economic development opportunities might be for the Inlet Valley. So that's the stretch as you come in to the city of Ithaca from Newfield between the two state parks. It's kind of a mishmash of properties right now. We'd like to be pretty intentional about hopefully fostering some new economic opportunities there. So we're just starting to finalize a plan with a consultant group that we've hired. So we know that that will be a multi-year project to try to put some things in place in the Inlet Valley. There's not much to report on our short-term rentals. We are exploring, I'm not on the committee, so I had to get some crib notes for this one. We are exploring options for enforcement from various service providers. And I think that this has certainly been talked about as a potential shared service between the town, the city, and the county, and maybe other municipalities as well. We have rethought some of how we're moving forward on drafting legislation for short-term rentals. Certainly the focus will be on owner-occupied units, and we will explicitly allow it in certain zoning areas. Don't ask me too many more questions about short-term rentals because I just wanted to mention short-term rentals hasn't dropped off of our screen. In fact, several of us like that we're still moving forward on things that have nothing to do with COVID-19. So I'll stop there to see if there's any questions.
Thank you very much, Rob. Questions to Rob? I see whose hand is that? Henry Granison?
Yeah, actually, Amanda's hand was up first.
Okay. I don't see a hand for okay, Amanda?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to thank you, Rod, for I had emailed Rod a couple times and some with the closing of 79 West, that there's a lot of traffic, truck traffic and bus traffic getting funneled down my street. And I had many constituents who were upset and concerned, also getting put, you know, cars and trucks coming down Warren Place and Hook Place, and there were some accidents. So I think there's been a lot of concern about that, and I reached out to Rod, and I think some constituents did it as well, and we got a speed sign in there, which I noticed, which is great. I don't think it's turned on yet, but hopefully it will be soon. So just thank you for being responsive to that, and I know that folks are out walking and, you know, being outside a lot more right now, and if when traffic is increased, that makes it a lot harder. So thank you for working on that.
And I think part of the issue was it took them a while to get all the detour signs up. Right. So for a while, sort of incomplete messaging that was going on. So I think that.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Amanda. Henry and then Rich.
Yes, Rod. With the Green New Deal, does that include also a green building code?
Yeah, so certainly there's been things that we've already been working on that, you know, just sort of lead into a more complete action plan. So we still are working, you know, it's kind of, that one has been paused a little bit in terms of finalizing the regulations for existing, I mean, new construction for green building. So there's not much, I mean, I talked to Nick Goldsmith about that today, and I think it's just been sort of stalled for a little bit because of what's going on right now. The idea is that after that is finalized, whenever it is, maybe this summer or the fall, they'll start working on a policy for existing buildings, which will be a pretty major challenge.
Okay. Also with the short-term rentals, you're only talking about, like, future control, not anything dealing with COVID-19?
Right, right.
Okay. That's what I thought. Thanks.
Thank you. Rich and then Martha.
Hi, Rod. Thank you for appearing. Perhaps I've missed this in the crush of other things. I was curious whether we have seen any resolution with the U.S. Postal Service at the downtown site, and if you're able to say anything about that.
Sure. So the current lease ends next July, 2021. So we have sent – they sent us a new draft lease that we've sent back our comments. So we're in – I don't know when they're going to get back to us, but we're in – there's going to be a going back and forth period, I'm sure, for a couple of months.
All right. Thank you. Martha?
Thank you, Leslin. Hi, Rod. I just really want to thank you and the rest of the board for continuing to consider a contribution and membership in the Community Housing Development Fund. That's wonderful. Do you have any sense of when you would make a decision? Is that part of
I think it's just going to be part of the budget process.
So...
You know, I think we'll have some signals this summer, whether it's something or not.
We do plan to have one round, one NOFA, Notice of Funding Availability, to be prepared, the deadline of September. So if the town wanted to be included with in that round, that's a time frame there, if you can consider that.
Thank you for that reminder. So good.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Question for Rob? No? Again, thank you so very much, Rob, for joining us and giving us an update on what's going on in the town of Ithaca. Sounds like good stuff happening. And I don't know if you've been to one of our meetings since you became supervisor. Have you?
I don't think I have. No, it's just...
No, well, then welcome. In your role as town supervisor, we're glad that you could do that.
I think Bill Goodman came to one since I started.
And the same goes for Beth, because I don't think you've been to one of her meetings either. So thank you both for being here. We'll move on to Dustin Nugent, who is a city council member, my representative on city council. Hi, Dustin. Glad you can join us today.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for representing me. So we've had a whole, we've had a meeting and both our committee meetings this month already. A lot of uncertainty. Our controller, Steve Thayer, says in his 30 years of service with the city, this is the most uncertainty and fiscal impact he's seen. It's unsettling. We're kind of hoping that the federal government ultimately steps up and helps fund some infrastructure projects. We deferred the South Cuyahoga Street rebuild for that reason, so that we will have a shovel-ready project kind of on deck in case some money does come through. We have also instituted a hiring freeze that includes, unfortunately, the sustainability director that was going to manage the city's Green New Deal. We still have the grant for doing our climate action plan. I don't know exactly how that'll proceed, but I will certainly push for Nick or someone else to continue that work, even if we don't have a sustainability director. It's a shame because we had, I hear we had four really good candidates. We've asked them to kind of stay on standby if they're able and to keep an eye out for if anything changes. But for now, we are freezing all hiring. You may have heard that the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has started constructing its dewatering facility at Southwest Park. Those residents of the jungle were not kicked off the property. They were relocated on site. I believe thanks to the county, they were offered hotel accommodations, but all of them declined. So they're relocating the site. Second Wind set up hand washing stations and porta potties. They're still there. This dredging project is, has been in the works for decades, so we're happy to see it continue finally.
Thank you. Thanks, Dustin. Always good to have you join us. Any questions? All right. No questions. Thank you. Martha has her hand up. Sorry. Go ahead, Martha.
Thanks, Dustin. I see you're taking the time at home to experiment with your hairstyle, and so is Jason. I noticed somebody was able to find a haircut. So I just wanted to let you know, and because you may be off the call by the time I fully report on state and federal stuff, but we are hearing from Amanda Spellacy in Schumer's office, that the White House has now agreed that the fourth coronavirus bill or COVID bill would support state and local funding in the fourth next bill, not the one that they're expecting to vote on today. I don't know if you saw the spreadsheet Amanda had sent around, but the Democratic proposal would have given sent $6.9 million to the city of Ithaca. So maybe that'll be the basis of the proposal for COVID-4. So did you get that to Savante and Dan, I believe? I don't know if that got sent around everybody.
It wasn't sent around, but I had heard that figure too. And when our deficit might be anywhere from 4 to 13 million, that's kind of like the middle. We'll take it. Whatever.
Right. But, and I want to just thank the city, and I think Tom Knight really spearheaded this for that. The business loan was if you want to talk a minute about the business resiliency program, grant program that TCAD and the Development Corporation are helping with as well. But maybe you can mention that, folks.
I think it was a you might actually know more than I did. He did describe it. I forget a lot of the details. I do know that it ran out very quickly. I have friends who tried to apply, and by the afternoon, all the spots have been depleted, unfortunately. So the need is very, obviously really, really high. But it was a a loan program for small businesses in the region. Right. But just like the Paycheck Protection Program gets depleted very quickly.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the city stepping up to initiate that. I know you pulled in a lot of donors for that, including Cornell. I think donated $100,000 to it.
$100,000,
so, yeah. So it was a great step. Maybe there's more to come. Thanks a lot, though.
There's also, thanks for reminding me, too, that the city has a portal on its website. It's also hosted at Ithaca Voice and other news sites that point people to services that are continuing to serve people via takeout or curbside shopping and delivery. So if you or anyone listening is in the market for food or other supplies, we have that resource.
Okay.
Also set up by Tom Knipe and our GIS folks.
All right. Thank you very much. Annie, you have a question?
Yes. Just a clarification. I've heard Martha mention Amanda a couple of times in meetings, and I just want to ask her if she wanted to clarify which Amanda she's talking about and from whose office.
I thought I mentioned Amanda Spellacy from Schumer's office. No?
No, you just said Amanda.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Thank you. Now we know which Amanda, as opposed to the Amanda that's above you in the square above you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dobson.
Stay safe.
Moving on. I am actually going to go straight to our folks at the EOC, see if there's anything to report from Jason, Frank, Amy, and others around COVID-19. Do you have anything you want to share with us? Anything new?
Leslie, I have a report that I was going to kind of give an updated timeline for our whole response. I can do that now, or I can do it during my report. Either way.
Why don't you go ahead and do it now? And I just have a big favor of everyone. It may sound like you're being very loud while you're there by yourself. You're not loud coming through. So if you can please speak into your microphones, it would be helpful.
Is that directed at me, Leslie? Am I not being loud enough?
Well, it is directed at you and others.
Okay. All right. I'm going to share a screen with you, if that's all right.
Sure.
Can everybody see that all right?
Yes.
All right. So what I thought we would do is give you an update, kind of picking up on the time frame where we left off at the last legislative meeting. Thanks to Dom and Jay and Amy for putting this together, a lot of the information. This will be kind of picking up over the last 2 weeks between our last legislative meeting. Can you see this change in page?
Yes.
All right, good. So this is the April 8th to April 14th. Week. Again, here's just an update. We'll make this available after the meeting. We'll also post it as well. But as you can see, that was a week. It seems it's only 2 weeks ago, but definitely feels a lot longer at times. That was when the first executive order came out regarding public-facing essential employees requiring masks. That unfortunately is also the week we had two deaths in the county. Which were actually not county residents, but they had come from New York City and unfortunately passed away here in Tompkins County. County operations, we had a lot going on. This is when we got ASAP CAB up and running in terms of being able to transport folks to the testing site or the sampling site over in Lansing, over by the mall. We continued to extend executive orders. And that weekend, the 11th and 12th, we also issued some guidance regarding parks and recreation facilities. I think Rod Howe mentioned that. I had some conversations with Rod as well as some of the town supervisors about parks and recreation direction as well as the city. And we gave some direction on that as well as a kind of a direction with respect to the business leaders. The following week, which was really last week and leading up to today, again, more executive orders, and there have been more that have been issued just over the last night and today as well. I think we're up to 21 now, actually, to be honest with you. They're kind of coming out without much notice. Well, that's not to say we didn't really receive any notice to begin with, but they're definitely coming out at all hours of the night as well without much explanation prior to or forewarning. And then really this expanded masks in terms of not only essential employees that are public-facing, but also encouraging folks to be able to wear masks in the public where social distancing can't be maintained. We also had quite a bit of positive media last week where we did some recordings. Leslie, you have been a part of them during some virtual town halls, pushing out new messages. We had some good coverage from some of our media partners. I think all of our media partners had done a story, whether it was on the EOC, whether it was on COVID, or whether it was on, I believe we had the National Telecommunicators Week last week, shining some good light to the good work that our county staff are doing, particularly the EOC and then our dispatchers. Here's some data that we have roughly put together. It is fluid and it is being updated as we go through it, but I thought it would be helpful for folks to kind of see a little bit of what's going on with respect to some of the hours worked and costs. So if I go across this top bar here, regular hours worked, that means the number of hours committed to COVID-19, which are regular hours. This is, you know, a regular eight-hour day. If it's my eight-hour day, or however many hours I work in that day, it goes towards regular hours and is committed towards COVID-19 hours. So since, mid-March or so when the EOC was open, I believe that's the starting date of this, but I'll get more details later. We've had about 20,000 plus hours committed towards COVID-19 response. About a little almost 1,700 hours of overtime hours. Regular pay, meaning this will be more important as we talk around about FEMA reimbursement. Regular pay is, again, the regular pay you would pay individuals for coming to work every day. Even if they've been reassigned, that amount of regular pay that's been committed towards COVID-19 hours is almost $700,000. Overtime pay is almost just under $22,500. And comp time is essentially time that is worked over the normal work day, but is not paid out. And that is... it's also not banked in its entirety. So in this case, comp time can be categorized as hours worked beyond the normal workday or workday and work week that are not paid out. And the reason we kept logging this is to kind of show you the value of it. So, for example, most of the folks in the EOC, for the better part, are considered similar to salary employees. So after they work their 40 hours in a week, if they work another 30 hours in the week, which is definitely the case in most circumstances, they don't get paid out for that time because they're salary employees. But we did keep a log of the value of it, and we'll continue to keep a log of the value of it. I'm going to come back to this in a second. I just want to get through the rest of the slide, and then I'll talk a little bit about FEMA reimbursement and what may or may not be eligible for FEMA reimbursement. Estimated emergency leave here. This is estimated emergency leave. So we've just done the two pay periods ending. The last one is at the 18th. There are some estimates, but as you can see, the number of employees that have claimed emergency leave is categorized as leave in which employees are non-essential, therefore they're not working, cannot work remotely because there's no means to, or they have dependent care or other means of which they can't work. And this could also be full-time and part-time. So an employee could be working 20 hours during the week remotely, but the other 20 hours, they're not working, therefore they're claiming 20 hours of emergency leave. This is a tracking mechanism that we've used to identify, and this is the number of hours total and the value over the past three pay periods, the amount of folks that essentially are not working in their normal duties. And down here are material-related expenses related to COVID-19. So this is probably not completely up to date as we continue to receive invoices and payments, and they're tracked a certain way. So I suspect this will continue to be updated. But for the most part, we had everybody go back and try to retrace and track any hard material costs that come to light as a result of the response. So something to keep in mind with this, and with this stimulus 3.5 that's being voted on right now, I think by the Senate and by the House, there are provisions in there that would make our costs 100% reimbursable by FEMA. Or under normal circumstances, now don't get too excited, because there's all right, I don't want you to get too excited yet. Let me finish my statement. Under normal circumstances, it would only be 75% reimbursed through FEMA. This legislation, if passed, will be 100% reimbursed by FEMA. That's great. However, FEMA reimbursed costs, they do not reimburse you, and I'm gonna look at everybody's faces when I say this. They do not reimburse you for hours that would normally be worked under a normal day. It's a work day. There are some exceptions, but right now, they're for the most part only reimbursed for overtime pay and then for harder material costs if they fall under a certain schedule. So this regular pay, of essentially where time has been, folks have been reassigned to the COVID-19 response, may not be reimbursed. There are certain nuances that we have to look at right now to determine if they've been completely shifted over to be reassigned, and we have to look through some regulatory measures in FEMA. But for the most part, it's usually only overtime, meaning if you are doing typical response, if you're responding to this emergency, and you would normally get paid during the eight-hour day, they would not reimburse you for that under normal circumstances. So what does that mean? It means this number here, estimated emergency leave, will not be reimbursed. This is essentially time lost, meaning productivity loss. We're continuing to pay our employees, but they're not necessarily working, so there's a loss of productivity in that case in terms of being able to further the departments they work into. Regular pay with COVID-19 hours and those hours worked, again, those are hours we're not working and doing our other duties. We're doing this response. So that's a little bit of a recap on hours worked, emergency leave, and related expenses. And we'll update this every 2 weeks as we go through each pay period to give you an up to date. And as we understand more about regular pay and what we think can be reimbursed and won't be, we'll be able to update that as well. I should also forewarn you that under normal circumstances, when FEMA reimbursed for expenses, where usually the disaster is localized or regionalized, typically reimbursement can take generally 12 to 24 months. Obviously, this is the first nationwide disaster that FEMA has ever had to respond to, so when that reimbursement can be expected is unknown at this time. And we'll continue to update the legislature as we update these numbers every 2 weeks. I'm going to go through the rest of the slides, and I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody may have. Here's a little recap just on COVID-related food distribution to date. The six Tompkins County school districts, these are the ones that are housed in the county. There are other school districts that touch on different elements or different parts of the county. We did not include those, but these are the primary six ones that are in the county. Just some meals, formula, diapers that have been delivered over the course of since March 16th to April 17th. Food net, number of meals and weekly deliveries. Food bank is not measured that way. Food bank, we're comparing what March of 19 was to March 20 in terms of households served and individuals served. So as you can see, food banks had a significant increase in their amount of food that they provided. Food net continues to provide a lot of food, and they also do wellness checks for their folks. And then the school districts are really an excellent partner in trying to deliver food, and they're also expanding a little bit outside the families in the school district. I know there's a lot of stories of individuals, neighbors, and so on and so forth that are getting food that normally wouldn't under normal circumstances. So that's a positive thing. Tompkins County, this is 211 contact. So week one is mid-March. This kind of just compares 2019 to 2020. Tompkins only contacts the 211. Again, 211, great partner. Has been a great resource. Our 211 system is really is well respected and has done a great job in really trying to shelter and be able to shelter, shepherd calls to where they need to be and folks getting the resources. So this is just a little bit of comparison of the increased use by week of the response. The first three weeks being most intense when the biggest changes came about, but they continue to be a great asset. And a great resource in this response. identified by needs. So this is a great slide just put together today about the different areas and what's being asked of 211 and by topic. There are other topics that are smaller in numbers that we do have the full report. We can share with the legislature just so you can see in a little bit more detail. But this shows pretty much a little bit of a span of the types of calls that they're getting around what topics specifically. Tax prep information still being the largest one. And lastly, just some basic public information and social media. The PIO team is by far pretty impressive. I think there's 6 or 7 total folks that are working on the PIO team, not all full-time, but Dominic and Sam are definitely working full-time, and there's a group of others that are spending a lot of time. And, the activity has really picked up. They've shown we've got a lot of interest, a lot of people using it to get their regular feeds of information. So pretty excited about the use of that and how it's been able to be developed. And that's also not talking about the virtual town halls that have been going on, some of the different radio discussions. I know Amy and I did a quick radio stint with Gary Stewart today on his show. We're definitely doing a lot of public-facing work and trying to engage, trying to get answers out there, trying to get information out to the public. So that kind of is just a brief recap. I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has of the past 2 weeks, and if there's anything specific about the data I can answer, I'd be happy to answer that now or get you the answers after the meeting.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Good information to get, especially the numbers and hours people are working and bad information about what we are or aren't going to get from FEMA, but real and true facts. Questions. I see Martha, and I need to see the whole – somebody else raised your hand, but I can't see you. So, Martha, go ahead.
Thank you. Jason.
I got nothing.
Great. Dominic, slide 4, back to that one with the personnel.
I'm sorry, Martha, you went out. You went in and out.
Yeah, you were frozen there.
Sorry.
I know. I'm having trouble here. I'm gonna take myself off of video. That might help. I think it was slide 4, if you could go back there with the FEMA expenses.
Yep.
Okay, I see on the emergency leave, 21st of March, 254 employees, 4th of April, 301. Is that 555 who are on emergency leave, or is it went from 254 to 301?
It went from 254 to 301. And so that's every pay period. So that can also mean part-time, a few hours. It could be full-time. It's not, it's just any employee that may have shown that they used 1 hour of emergency leave, that would be included as one employee.
Okay.
Jason, may I ask a follow-up? And employees are self-tracking what they use for emergency leave?
Yes. So it's obviously input. There was guidance given a month ago about what emergency leave was and how to track it. So it's in coordination with their supervisors, Leslin. So I mean, is it a perfect system? Have we captured everyone? Are there some people that may not be putting it down? Sure. But I think it's a good – it captures the most part.
It's as good as we can get.
Probably for now, until we go back and refine it a little bit further.
And then on the comp time, the 78,000, is there a point – can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Is there a point – are we going to be comping people – some or all of this, or does this end? I mean, how does this work, or is that just? I hope it's not just a donation from the employees. How does this work as far as compensating people for that?
Well, under normal circumstances, they wouldn't get compensated. I mean, these are hours above and beyond their 40 hours that they normally work, and they're not titles that are entitled to overtime pay. So, okay. At some point in time, as we get through this response, I do think it's fair and reasonable to have a conversation about these individuals and these employees, that have worked. It's probably from 20 or less that have that have been a major part of the response that are essentially salaried employees, but yet they do not get compensation above and beyond those hours worked, or you know, their 40-hour work week.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Martha. I see Anna, and I don't know who else has their hands up. So if you do, you might have to chime in. So Anna, go ahead.
Thank you. Jason, could you go to your second to last slide?
Yep. This one?
Yeah, this is great. It would be wonderful to see this progress as we go through legislative meetings, so you could see trend data and see which ones are increasing, decreasing, depending on the impact of the prolonged being in pause with our economy.
Yeah, we can definitely do that.
Thank you. That was a very valuable slide. Go ahead, Anne. I'm sorry.
That's okay. The other is simply if you could email these slides out after the meeting, that would be great.
Yeah, we will make this available to everyone, and we'll probably post it as well next to the last presentation we did.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Who else has their hand up?
Leslyn, this is Beth McGee in Enfield. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Jason, I just want to clarify with you. We're going to be continuing our conversation in Enfield about the wisdom of our decision about the partial unemployment. And there had been some discussion where a board member had thought that we were going to be reimbursed for the money that we were paying employees for not working. And the hours not worked that we have opted to pay them, those are just regular highway hours. Those, they've not been reassigned for any COVID-19 response or anything like that. That's just whatever we had to pay them to get them up to compensation for a 40-hour week during this time. So am I to understand you correctly that that is not money that's reimbursable through FEMA?
So I think, let me just make sure I understand your question. You're basically saying that individuals that have not been working throughout this response, but have been getting paid because you're required to under the executive order of the governor, I believe it was executive order 20204, are you going to get, or can you get reimbursed for FEMA? My understanding is no, you cannot. I did ask the question of our governor's rep, that same question of is the governor going to compensate us for requiring, you know, for basically requiring us to continue to pay employees so they do not use accruals if they are non-essential and not working. And the response I did get from the state is that most likely they will not reimburse us for that.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. So
they have been actually deemed by the board as essential, but the highway superintendent has opted not to have them work on anything but, you know, the maintenance of the highway building or just pothole filling. So those were determined by Cornell Local Roads as essential tasks. So this is really just regular highway hours and not separate. So, okay, I just wanted to be clear on that. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. And, Beth, for that moment, we made you an honorary legislator. Well, thank you for that, Jason. Are there other legislators that have questions? Any other legislators? All right. Jason and folks in the EOC, thank you for that report. Jason, is there anything else or report from you? Anything else you want to add?
Sure. I can speak a little bit to the discussion around federal stimulus bills and my conversations recently with NYSAC briefly. Up until this past weekend, there was a state and local municipal portion of stimulus 3.5. For whatever reason, that did not make its way through to this most recent version. And
Jason, before you continue, can I ask you to please stop sharing your screen? As I can't see the rest of the legislators, and I don't know who's raising hands or not.
There you go. I apologize.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt, but go ahead.
No, that's all right. My bad. Up until a few hours ago, there was not a consensus or an understanding if there may be a stimulus 4.0, so to speak. It appears that this will be something to be worked on. NYSAC doesn't have any clear direction as to whether it could be next week or whether it could be next month, so we'll continue to stay abreast of that and continue to monitor it. I would second both what the town and the city have said with respect to budget challenges. We're continuing to do our preparation and analysis and what budget impacts we think are ahead of us, and we'll have more information for the legislature in the next week or so about what we're seeing, both from a state aid perspective and what we may be losing from state aid. I think that plays a much bigger role in our budget than it does in any other municipality, because a good portion of it is state aid reimbursables. And obviously with the governor's new broad authorities this year, he has the ability to cut state aid and reimbursables, both from capital and operations, at three times throughout this year, April 30th, which is coming up, June 30th, as well as December 31st. So we are doing some analysis around sales tax, around potential state aid and other major revenues, and know what those impacts are. We're also talking with department heads about expense reductions and curtailing, as well as our partner agencies. So those conversations have been happening this week. We'll have more information for you later next week as well. Two things also that make it very difficult, which I think everybody understands, is that there's a lot of uncertainty as to what the future holds. How do we curtail? How do we know what a reopening would look like? How do we know how the economy will respond? How do we know what consumer confidence will respond to the opening or reopening of an economy or businesses? All of these are unknowns, which makes it increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to predict. There are two things that I think weigh on people's minds. One is there's a resurgence of this disease at a later date. How will that impact our economy if we're not prepared? And two, which is probably more local to us, is what happens if students do not return this fall with concerns of the disease. Both the questions I have no answers to, nor does anybody, but I think all factors that will go into our budget discussion considerations as we go forward in the upcoming weeks and months. Other than that, I have nothing else to update the legislature on unless you have any other questions.
Thank you, Jason. Rich? Please speak into your microphones.
Yes. Thank you, Leslie. Jason, I was wondering if you could just talk to what the plan for advisory boards and whether they're going to be brought back online now we have Zoom capability, or is there, have you just not gotten to that yet?
You're asking about advisory boards, Rich?
Here.
I know Jonathan is going to talk about advisory boards in his update.
Yes, as part of my report, I'd asked Jonathan to give us a little bit of information, so you'll hear about that soon. Anyone else has a question for Jason on his report?
Okay.
Thank you, Rich.
Does he want to make his appointment?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. I forgot. Again. I apologize. Thank you, Kathy. I sent you a belated email. I apologize. If I go back in time a year ago, the legislature approved a full-time position on a one-time basis as a training position for Don Ellis as he planned to retire as the director of Weights and Measures. We filled that position. We interviewed, we posted, we interviewed that support position and filled it with Aaron Becker. Aaron has learned under Don over the past year or so, and Don retired at the end of March. In the midst of everything, I apologize, I forgot to bring this to the legislature at the last meeting, his confirmation. Aaron has been filling the role of director for the past month, but does require your confirmation in order to continue in his appointed role. A little history. Aaron has worked for the county for several years, first with the airport and then also with highway as a mechanic. So he has a few years of service with us and has been filling the role quite well in the turbulent times over the past month. So unless there are questions or considerations around Aaron, I'd be happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I'd request your confirmation for his appointment.
All right, are there questions, or does anyone wish to go into executive session to discuss this employee? Mike Lane has his hand up, followed by Amanda. Mike Lane?
Yeah, I don't want an executive session, but what I want to say is that I think at the time that, first of all, in budget, when we were discussing the position of the deputy, over a couple of years, we were expecting to get a person who could move into the directorship as soon as Don retired. So I think this is actually the game plan to move him in and to make his appointment permanent.
Thank you, Mike. Amanda?
Yeah, thank you. I just couldn't remember if we – is he going to have – is Aaron going to have a deputy or a part-time person working with him? I know we talked about that last year, I think, but I can't remember.
Sure. So, actually, this goes back 2 or 3 years because this had started about 2 years ago. The individual that was put in the role had left, and then that extended Don's retirement another year. And then Aaron was hired last year. So the position in the budget now is a one-time position to carry over, and with the expectation that if Don was to stay on a little bit after Aaron's appointment, just to support him and give him any more additional training, he could. So it's not a permanent position. It was just a one-time appointment this year.
Okay.
I think I need to move in a second.
Okay. Thank you.
You need a motion, Leslie?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if there are no other questions, I'll take a motion to confirm this appointment.
I will make that motion.
Seconded by Rich. Any other comments? Roll call vote. All in favor? We'll go through the roll call. Go ahead.
Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mooring?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you all very much. Let him know that the legislature appreciates all the time he's been putting in and we're happy to make this confirmation happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy.
Okay. That's it for you, Jason?
Yes, it is.
Anything else you forgot?
I hope not.
All right. As I was saying very quickly, legislators had asked, you know, just as part of my report, I began looking into getting the advisory boards back up and running. We had put everybody on pause as we try to figure out which end was up when COVID-19 hit and hit us fast. I reached out to Jonathan just asking questions around open meetings laws, who's responsible for that when it comes to advisory boards, if anybody has to be following those or not. And I asked Jonathan to come in tonight and share with us some more information so that we can move forward with getting our advisory boards up and moving. Jonathan, are you still with us?
I am. Can you see me and hear me?
Oh, my gosh, we can see you.
Yeah, I go on the policy that no reason to see me when I'm not speaking. Probably what I have to do either. But so obviously people are anxious to get the advisory boards up and going. You all know, of course, about the governor's executive order, which affects this meeting here, which says we can have it remotely. Interestingly, that does not cover most advisory boards because what it does is make an exception to the open meetings law. And as you may recall, when we did the recent open meetings policy, that many of the advisory boards that are and those boards that are purely advisory are not covered by the open meetings law. What they are covered by is our county policy, which basically says a couple of different things about advisory boards, other than the few like the Board of Health, which we treat just like this board. It says that the meeting shall be open to the public, that it does not require the same notice that we give for other meetings, but it says that they shall do some notice, and it does not require them to keep minutes, but it says that if they keep minutes, they shall provide it, which is different from the legislature and its committees. So the question is, what do we do about advisory boards? At the beginning, back in early March, I think it was March 13th, when we did the first executive order, it gives the county administrator the power to change the policies and rules because of COVID-19 during the emergency period. So basically, we have the power, Jason has the power under the previous executive order to do whatever we feel is appropriate in terms of the advisory committees continuing to meet. We do think that they should still be open to the public, but obviously not in the way that they were previously. And other than that, I mean, that's really the main requirement. The biggest issue with advisory committees is, of course, there are like 40 of them, and we don't have the staff or the licenses to provide this kind of service like we have right now to all of them. So what we're going to propose and what Jason's going to try to do is have the advisory committees meet, but they have to kind of make their own arrangements, similar to actually what they do now, but they have to make some arrangement for the public to be able to listen in, mostly because the county just doesn't have the resources or even the licenses, et cetera, to do it for 40 other organizations. So that's what we plan to do. You know, at the moment, under the prior order of the county administrator, they're not to meet at all. So this would open them up to meeting, but it would still require them to make efforts to make them available to the public. We could have them not available to the public, but we felt that people would not want that. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I mean, obviously, it's going to be something of a process. Different committees are going to be in different positions and have different resources. But the county is really not in a position to provide this kind of service for all of them. Let's say that. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm not sure if that answers everybody's concerns or not.
Thank you, Jonathan. So I have a quick follow-up before I recognize some of my other colleagues. Are there any of our advisory boards that are more than just advisory? There's other pseudo-governmental, and we have to, is there any concern about that? Do we have any of those?
Sure. Well, there are some, and in our open meetings policy, there are three that we expressly recognize as that. I can't remember exactly what they are off the top of my head, but one was the Board of Health, I recall. And that doesn't necessarily mean that was our thoughts on what we knew were three that had would be subject to the open meetings law under state law. That doesn't necessarily mean there are no others, but those three we identified at the time of the policy. Others, for example, the Public Information Advisory Board, for example, you know, there's obviously nothing in state law about that. That's purely advisory. So that would definitely not be covered. Most of them would not be covered. We identified three at the time we did the open meetings policy that would, but I can't swear that there aren't any others which might. I think most of them would be kind of familiar with their own whether they do make actual legally mandated decisions by state law. Also, by the way, several subcommittees have their own bylaws, which are approved by the legislature, but you know, those two would be suspended just like the normal rules under the county administrator's order.
Okay. Thank you. Annie, Henry, Amanda, in that order.
Thank you. So, Jonathan, as far as the committees letting the people look at or observe what's going on in the committee meetings, does that have to be real time or just a recording?
I think it should be real time. I mean, you know, given that there's not a state requirement, you could change that. But I think real time would be just as practical and probably more in keeping with the, you know, with the spirit of open meeting.
Okay, so that might cause that might be a lot of work to do, because I know even the municipalities trying to get that done in real time is a challenge, to open to anybody in the public.
I had discussed that with the county administrator, and there may be some mm-hmm. committees which might have difficulty with that, and for those we can make an accommodation. I mean, you know, for those that really aren't required to have an open meeting under state law at all, if they can't do it, you know, if they really can't accommodate the public, then they could probably have a meeting without the public. But that's sort of a last resort. We want to do that more on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, if there is important that they meet and they really couldn't provide access to the public, but we don't want that to be the general rule.
Okay, and then do we have any idea when this advisement will be going out to those committees?
Well, we didn't think until after this meeting right here that this would be okay with the legislature. I think the county administrator would do that as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Henry?
Yes, Jonathan. So is the problem that there's not enough Zoom licenses to go around for all the committees?
Yeah, that's my understanding. I mean, I wasn't directly involved in that, but that's what I heard, I think, from Greg and Kathy, that we just didn't have the not only don't we have, you know, we're short-staffed there to begin with, and they don't really have the functional capability of doing that, but I understand the licenses are limited as well.
Okay.
That's it, Henry?
Yep.
All right, thank you. Amanda?
I just want to clarify what you're saying, because I feel like it's a little confusing. So you're saying that advisory boards can meet, but they have to meet remotely, and they have to set up something so the public can attend in real time if possible, but not, they don't have to.
I think that's exactly right. But if they are going to not have the public participate, or that they can't do it otherwise, they should get a special exception from the county administrator, because we don't want that to become the rule. You know, committees just deciding, okay, well, we'll not do it without the public.
Right. I mean, I think I'm sure you know this, to have to be really clear, because people are sort of itching to meet again, and somebody could set up their own personal Zoom and, you know, have some folks join, and they might call that a meeting, but that might not really be the actual, you know, EMC meeting or something. So as long as you're going to be really clear about what you want them to do or not do.
We'll have to get a clear message out to the advisory board committees, and particularly to their chairs, to distribute about, you know, just what the new rule is. Because at the moment, they've been told not to have them at all. This will certainly be an improvement for those who are anxious to meet.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
So my intention is to follow up with Jason. I just wanted Johnson's folks have been asking Jonathan to sort of give us the legal piece of it. The executive order and suspension came from the person with that responsibility, which is your county administrator. So I'll be following up with him to see when and what the expectations are, so we can have that guidance go out at the appropriate time. I see his hand up.
Deborah had her hand up.
Somebody else saying something?
Oh.
Yeah, I've been trying to attract your attention.
No, I got it. I was waiting for Leslyn to call on you.
Okay, go ahead, Deborah, and then Martha.
Okay, so I have to,
I have to fess up that my climate and energy board has just been going great guns. And we have had meetings on the members' Zooms. And, you know, actually Martha's attended both of them. So she's a member of the public, at least with respect to the committee. My question is really, I mean, we apparently the person whose Zoom we're using can accommodate up to 100 people. But the issue I raise is, how would you suggest we get the news out that there's going to be a meeting?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because we have that issue now. In that we leave that, unlike committee meetings of the legislature, for advisory boards, we leave that to them to get the news out, and actually that's part of the policy. How they'll get it out to the public is, you know, at the moment there's probably a deficiency in that, as is, even before COVID-19, in that unlike, you know, the notices which are on our website for the county and all the committees, the advisory boards don't have that. And they are left to getting the message out in different ways, usually through whatever department they work with. But I think it'll probably end up going out in the same way that they currently, it'll just have a message how people could participate. But it's already an imperfect system.
Okay. I feel less guilty now.
I don't know if you're that, you're off the hook that easily, Deborah, violating the executive order.
I'm just a disobedient person.
Martha?
So, Jonathan, Jason, do you need anything from us, or is it just you're reporting and then you're looking and you move on?
Yeah, I think no. I mean, he already has the powers under the previous executive order, just didn't want to exercise them without making sure that it was okay with you.
Okay. I think it's true that it's the departments, I guess, that when there's typically a staff person who sends out a notice and they have their distribution lists. And I guess you're right. I don't know if there's any public notice that I could think of. So then I'll just continue to go through departments. Correct?
Some of them, yeah. Essentially. Oh, go on, Jason.
I said some of them, yeah. Some of them that have departments that'll be able to do, and some of them won't. Not every department has WebEx or other licenses or Zoom licenses. So, unfortunately, you know, it also becomes an issue of being able to support them from an IT perspective when there's complications that arise from time to time, and they're not always during work hours. So, I think what we'll do is we'll issue some guidance. I'll work with Jonathan on putting probably a letter of guidance together to the advisory boards, let it go and see how it pans out, and if we need to make adjustments, we'll make adjustments. Hopefully soon enough, the weather will be nice enough, they can all sit 6 feet apart outside somewhere and into a park or something.
I don't know. It's snowing here.
Thank you very much, Lee. Martha, it's interesting because the last time we were meeting, we were all having nice weather and it was raining your way. I'm not sure what to make of that, but okay.
It's the crown jewel, right. You know.
If there are no other questions for Jonathan, or Jonathan, anything else from you?
Nope, that's it.
We'll move on to the gentleman who's bringing us a little bit of sunshine, our finance director, Rick Schneider.
Hello.
Good to see you. Hi, Rick.
You want sunshine? I'm looking out the window. I don't see it, but we do have some in the sales tax report. In your agenda packet on page 4 and 5 is what was submitted for the months of January and February. So we'll look at those first for sales tax. And then I also sent you all an email today at 3 o'clock that updated it even further with March's sales tax distribution. So we have 3 months to look at tonight, the whole first quarter, which gives us a bit of good news. Before I get into the the numbers of the report. Jason and I had discussed for planning purposes as we go forward, trying to do some prognostication on future sales tax. He and I dug a little deeper. What we always bring to you and as January sales tax is really for sales that took place in the month of December. So every time we bring you a report, whether it's January or February or March, it actually is for sales that took place in the preceding month. And he thought that was important to note because when we're looking in detail at the months of January, February, March, and the numbers look pretty good, the question, why does March look so good, even though there was a downturn in March? Why is this quarter looking so good? Well, we're really bringing to you a report that is for retail sales that took place in December, January, and February. Now, that's just the way the state reports to us. We get money in January for what is really money that the state got in December, but it was for the prior period that the retail sales were made in November. So I wanted you to understand that time lag, and that might shed a lot of light for us, not just for the planning of trying to get through COVID-19 and what the budgetary impact is on us for the rest of the year, but for all sales tax reports in the future. I think it was a real find to be able to dig deep and find out what the data is behind each of these sales tax reports. So let's look at the January sales tax report that I had sent in your packet. You can see that the county's portion of sales tax distributions was up 8.37% compared to last year. And that meant it was an increase of about $240,000 year over year. So, again, we call that the January sales tax report. The state calls it the January sales tax report. We have to report it in the same way, the same vernacular that the state uses. If you look at the next page, which was the February sales tax report, you'll see, again, we had a very positive month, and that was up 7.9%. So that represented an increase year over year. Now we're up to $427,423 year over year. So at that point in time, the year over year estimate was around 8% that we were up. Now today, and I just finished it today, and I wanted to get it on tonight's agenda. It's not in your agenda, but in the email that I sent you today, I gave you my whole summary report, which is what I'm reading from, and the next item on the auction. But in the March data and what I shared by email with you today, you can see that sales tax distributions for March actually went down 3.8%. for the month of March. Again, that reflects true sales that happened in February. So we don't have anything that's current enough to reflect what's been happening in March and April, which makes our job even harder trying to budget some projections. As of the end of March, year-to-date tax distributions were $8.9 million compared to $8.6 million in 2019. That's an increase of $299,000 or 3.47%. I also included the first quarter sales tax report that basically shows the same thing. We were up 3.47% compared to last year, and it is a high quarter for us. And I thought a little bit of good news was worth bringing to you to know that at least going into this horrendous situation that we're in with the emergency, that at least we had a good first quarter going into that. And then I had some remarks I wanted to make on the upcoming foreclosure auction. But first, are there any questions on sales tax?
Any questions on the sales tax report from Rick? Martha's your hand up? Or you just put that to take you down?
Actually, my hand was up about legislative privilege of the floor.
Yeah, I'm on it.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Henry, is your hand up for sales tax report? Go ahead.
Rick, how are you going to to guesstimate for future sales tax reports or for the year?
We don't really know right now. Jason, you want to start that? We have no data, no live data, and we won't for about 3 weeks. May 3rd to the 13th is when the first sales tax data comes in for April, or for which is actually the month of March. So we really have no data to manipulate at this point in time. Jason?
Sure. It's a tricky question, the way we are approaching it is we've been able to download quarterly data by industry for the past several years through the tax and finance website. So Kevin and I are working on a sales tax model that will be able to hopefully understand trends, and then maybe we can start to put in some variables to do some projections. Now, the problem is those variables are really variable. There's no way of really being able to – we'll have to pick some scenarios and then play them out. One thing we have got off the U.S. Census data is March 2020 sales compared to March 2019 sales. And, you know, not to be grim, but the certain industries that are higher earning industries in our sales tax makeup are range from a 20 to a 50% decrease in the month of March compared to March of 19. And that's only being shut down or closed for 2 to 3 weeks of March. So I suspect April will be even more dismal than March. But we won't know that until – we won't know March's actuals until probably early May, like Rick said, and then April's actuals to early June. So we're going to do some different modeling. We also have another kind of data point based on some data that NYSEC gave us on some projections that the Office of Management and Budget did. On pandemic scenarios and what it may do to GDP. So we're going to try to triangulate some different resources, but that's what makes this so difficult is we have no basis to project on. You know, some people have discussed in the past when you look at certain disasters like the 9/11 disaster or even localized disasters like floods or natural disasters. The problem with that is those are regionalized or localized, so everything around them still function as they normally would. This isn't the case, obviously. So it makes it very difficult, and we're just going to have to look at different scenarios and month by month update it with real-time data and then tweak those scenarios as to how we think they'll play out. But it really makes projecting very difficult. Even, like I said, under circumstances of opening back up. The governor's talked about, you know, opening up by region, depending on how that develops over the course of the next few weeks. That may happen on a very gradual scale, but consumer confidence still is an important piece of this puzzle. Are people going to feel confident? Well, restaurants are your number one industry, number one contributing industry to your sales tax makeup. And to what extent will they open, and to what extent will consumer confidence be restored? Is going to determine how well and how strong they come back. So that's a long answer, but the short answer is we don't really know, and we're just going to have to create some different modeling and look at variables to make some decisions on.
You talked about the quarterly reports. Are those actually to March, the end of March, or are those also like the sales tax, December through February?
So the information we would get from the state is the December, January, February numbers, right?
Right.
So, our first quarter, January, February, March, is really December, January, February sales, like Rick said. So it really doesn't matter as long as we're all looking at the data the same way. You know, as long as we get it right, whether it's December, January, February, March, it really doesn't matter. Just make sure that when we get the raw data, we're looking at it through the same lens.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Mike Lane?
Yes, thank you. Rick, I don't envy you guys on trying to project this sales tax. It's incredibly hard with what's going on. But I'm thinking about this almost $750,000 hit we have with AIM and this new hospital fund. Are we going to try to take that and somehow prorate it over our sales tax, or are we just going to say, well, we only get whatever we get?
So with respect to the hospital distress fund that you're talking about, Mike, is that what you're
referring to? Yeah, where they're going to take our sales tax money, yep.
You're just not going to see it. They're just going to take it off the top of it. So,
I know, but that don't we have to figure that into our projection as to getting less money?
You do in this case because your base, it's a new base for you. The other trickier thing, although when we look at this, Kevin and I spoke about this, the other thing is that it's actually not being, it's not expected to be paid until next year, although it doesn't matter. You got to take it out of this year because this is where it's going to come from. But, you know, the state wants the, wants it to be paid. They're doing us a favor by pushing off the payment date till next January. But it's really coming out of this year and next year.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike and Jason. Rick, you had something else you wanted to share?
Yeah, two things. I just remember we had mortgage tax checks just go out to municipalities along with their sales tax checks. And, I mean, mortgage tax checks can go up or down about 15% up or down either way each year because, as you know, it's based on sales. And it's based on sales within each locality. So there's always some winners and some losers when the mortgage recording tax checks go out. Now, we only send these checks out every 6 months. And in the beginning of April is that time when Maureen and I calculate those. And those checks went out to the tune of $961,000 spread out to all our municipalities, plus the amount that TCAT gets from mortgage recording tax. That was only down 3.3% from last year. So that's relatively good because I see swings, like I said, from 10 to 15% in between any 2 years because it's such a kind of an erratic flow of money that comes in based purely on real estate transactions. So that was kind of an even keel, and that was a very good number for the municipality seeing that coming in at this important period of time, along with their sales tax dollars. My last item was to discuss the auction a little bit, and I put the report out in my email today in that PDF that you can read, but I'll bring you the highlights of where we're going with the foreclosure auction. I brought it to the GO committee the last time we met, a number of options in the way we could proceed. There was 1, 2, 3, which ranged from postponing the auction and everything that's involved with the auction to date long down the road, or keep everything right on track as if everything was normal, or something in between. And we chose the in-between course of action, and that amounts to this, and this is what we discussed at the GO committee. We postpone the June auction and push it back to July or August, but we will stay on track for all the internal proceedings, which means the work that the Department of Planning and Sustainability does in bringing their recommendations to pull certain properties from the auction list, and they should be doing that and on track for doing that for the May 7th Government Operations Committee meeting. We also will continue to do all our internal work here as far as the record keeping and the interest calculations and everything that goes on behind the scene in the Treasury Department as if we were going to do the auction in June. But the final last few dates, and those are the important ones, would be pushed out to a future period in time. Now, when the executive order came out from the governor on March 20th that had to do with not kicking people out of their homes and suspending mortgage foreclosures and things like that, I posed the question to Jonathan because many of the county treasurers all across New York State were asking the same question. What do we do? How do we plan going forward? And I've heard responses that basically fall in any one of those three options that we discussed at the GO committee about postponing things or keeping it right on track. Jonathan advised me that there shall be no foreclosure of any residential or commercial property for a period of 90 days. That's literal, right from the executive order. But he thought, and you can't tell, that that wasn't really what the governor was probably thinking of at the time, was tax foreclosures. Obviously, he was thinking more of the regular commercial mortgage foreclosures. But on its face, it seems that it could be meant to apply to tax foreclosures. So it really was a moot point, as Jonathan and I discussed by email, because in all likelihood, we were going to push these dates back. There's no way that we want to be able to go out in the middle of all this and put notices on property and meet property owners, et cetera, et cetera. So my question for Jonathan was, how do, if I know I want to move those final dates near the end of the process back a month or two, how do I do that? And he said, it's up to me as the enforcing officer for this type of real estate transaction with the county to go ahead and set the dates. And so if I make a decision to postpone the auction, which I think is why I'm bringing it to you tonight, that's what I'm respectfully asking of us to agree upon, to postpone the final day of the auction, all I have to do is set those new dates and bring it to you and report it to you. So what I'd like to do, of course, is postpone the June auction. And the very next activity that I would be doing in my office, if we were on schedule, would be to go out and do that property tour. Jay Franklin usually goes along with me. Another member of my staff goes out. Drew went with me last year, and the auctioneer goes, and we tour the properties. We take pictures. We post the final notices. That would be the next thing that was supposed to happen on April 29th. Obviously, that is not going to happen. So that notice, which tells the amount of taxes due and the final date they can pay, which at that point was going to be May 15th, it also tells them the auction date, which, as it was previously set, was June 22nd. So here's the dates that I'm going to lay out that I think would work best for us, knowing, of course, that they can be adjusted once again as we move forward 30, 60 days down the road. They're tentative dates at best, but they're dates that we can use internally so that we keep the process moving. The auction tour would be moved from April 29th now to Wednesday, June 24th. That's 2 months later. The last day that property owners could pay to us would be moved from May 15th now back to July 15th. Again, a two-month delay. The date of the auction information meeting, which is that meeting which we always hold 1 week before the auction to get gather people from the public in there so they can look at all the different properties on the screen, that will be moved from June 15th up to August 10th. And the date of the auction, originally scheduled for June 22nd, would be moved up to Monday, August 17th. So that's just moving everything out 2 months. And I cannot tell you if that's realistic, not realistic, but we need a plan here in-house so that we can at least keep governing our staff and telling them what to do when. So we're basically going to recap that. We're basically going to continue all the foreclosure steps that we normally do within the usual time frames according to our usual procedures, with the exception of those last four dates that come at the tail end, the most important dates at the very end, everything being moved out 2 months.
All right.
The Treasury Division needs these dates so that they can contact Reynolds Auction Company, reschedule with them, and try to get an agreement and a contract with them. And they also will contact the Eagles Club, which is probably going to be the venue this year for the auction. And we already had that room set up for the June. We need to reschedule and reorganize that. And I just wanted to bring you up to date on how we're rescheduling some of those dates at the end of the auction. Are there any questions on this item?
Thank you, Rick. Does anyone have any questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for following along. I think Annie has a question.
Yes, thank you. So just thinking about the crisis that we're in right now as far as the pandemic, maybe you already mentioned this. Were these properties that were already having trouble for many months in the past? that will be foreclosed on. These aren't ones that are going to have problems right
these
now.
These properties where we actually began the proceedings in October of last year, and for residential properties, they're people who are 3 years behind or arrears in taxes. So they've been in trouble for a considerable length of time. And for commercial property and vacant property, it's 1 year behind or delinquent in taxes. So these are not properties that are distressed as a result of anything that's going on right now. These are troubled properties where the taxes haven't been paid over multiple periods, multiple years.
Thank you. Just wanted to make that clear for myself and for the public. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. That was actually good, Annie. If there's nothing else for Rick, I'm being aware of the time. I know Barbara Ekstrom has been waiting, and I didn't sleep on the fact that you all haven't had privilege on the floor for legislators. If you really have to, which I'm sure some people do. So can you make it snappy, privilege of the floor for legislators, and then we'll take resolution A so Barbara can go to sleep? Legislators, anything you want to report on the privilege of the floor for legislators? Martha?
Thank you. Just really quickly, I do want to thank Deborah for doing that proclamation, 50 years for Earth Day. That's boy, I wish we could say what a good way we've come, but it seems not really. Just in that context, the Climate Action Council had its first meeting. That's the state council that was to develop the plans for the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, CLCPA, that met in February. Its second meeting was supposed to be April 2nd. That was canceled, and as far as I know, no other meeting has been scheduled. So looks like the progress that we were hoping for hasn't really been moving along yet.
Yeah.
But thank you again, Deborah.
Thanks, Martha. Anyone else has anything burning you'd like to report on? Even if it's not burning, you'd like to say something. Mike Lane?
I want to say a couple things about the TC3 situation. We had the TC3 board meeting, which I attended last week, and a couple things I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of. First of all, commencement will not happen in May, of course. That has been pushed back to no certain date at this point. They hope to have a commencement in August. That's not for sure. Another possibility might be to have it in December when they have their December annual event. They really want to have a live commencement for the students because it's so important to students and families. The Global Connection Program will not happen this summer. Remember, a lot of the global students are in their own countries, particularly the Dominican Republic, and they have their own issues with the COVID-19 pandemic. So there's a hope that might be able to be pushed back until the fall semester. The colleges that TC3 corresponds with in, for example, Dominican Republic, really want to see this go forward for their children. For their students, I should say. So that's kind of important to know. That is a really important program that has been part of TC3 for a real long time. We did see an interim report from the interim chief financial officer, Bill Talbot. They've been doing a lot of serious thinking about what's going to be happening. They're hoping that there'll be money coming in under the first stimulus act, over $1 million. I think it's 1.6 or 1.7. Maybe Jason knows that figure, but that will help. But what they've been projecting, even what would happen if there was a 30% decline in enrollment. Now, they're not hoping that it's going to be that. They aren't for sure, but they're saying, what would it do to the budget of the college if that happened? And they're looking at that. It could mean over a $3 million deficit to TC3. As you know, in the governor's budget that got adopted by the legislature, there not only wasn't any new money for community colleges, there was a cutback to 2 years ago funding for community colleges. Community colleges don't have the support that the rest of SUNY has. I think it's because the counties share part of the burden, and it's easier for the legislature to say, well, let the counties do more. And, of course, we know how hard that is. So I wanted to make those points and just let you know that our college, our college president and financial people up there are working very hard. Oh, one other point I wanted to mention. There are currently about 80-some students left in the dormitories up there. They were not required to go home. They do have food service, and a lot of them didn't want to choose to go home. They wanted to stay where they were. The courses this summer will all be remotely taught. None of them will be on campus. Live productions, or whatever you want to call live lectures. But the one of the things that's happening with the students who have gone home, where they are trying to teach them with the remote lectures, et cetera, is some of the students are having technical problems having the ability to use the computer at home, for example. Maybe their parents are trying to do work from home. Maybe their other siblings are there needing to use those computers and the broadband width for public schools or other things. So it's not an easy thing for the students to get their education continued when they haven't signed up for these kind of remote teaching. And it's hard on some of the faculty who are not used to teaching other than in the classroom, and they're having to get used to that. So let's all keep that in mind, especially if we hear folks saying that it's just not working for students. We need to get these kids back in the classrooms as soon as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for sharing all of that, and especially for the acknowledgement of some of the problems and difficulties that folks
I'm always very proud of TC3. They always look at these difficulties and face them head on, always have.
Indeed.
With the budgets and everything else, and they're a good example.
Indeed. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, if we can just take up our consent agenda and look at Resolution A. So like I said, so Barb can go on about her business. Consent agenda. These are resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. Under Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, we have, Shauna, did you have your hand up for something?
You're muted, Shauna.
Go ahead.
I just needed to add Resolution 9312.
You just need to what?
Add Resolution 9312
to the... Oh, you want to do the withdrawal and so on of resolutions from the agenda. All right, why don't we just go ahead?
Sorry.
Go ahead. Okay.
If I could...
About it.
Okay. It's a resolution calling on the state of New York to release enhanced federal Medicaid matching funds to counties and New York City.
We want to add this to the agenda. We need 10 votes to add to the agenda. So Sean is moving this resolution.
Yes, please.
Someone seconded. Rich did. And now we need a vote to add it to the agenda. Go ahead. Roll call vote.
Mike Stigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich Jung?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Absolutely, yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mooring?
Yes.
Martha Robertson? Martha Robertson?
No.
Sorry, yes.
Leslie Nippine Clairborn?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no.
Okay, that's added to the agenda. Thank you very much. Now let's go back to our consent agenda. And I was calling on Resolution A. There's a small change to Resolution A on the first whereas. Instead of April 2022, it's supposed to be 2023. So that was just a small error that was me in typing. But Resolution A, award of contract, landfill, groundwater sampling and analysis, Department of Recycling and Materials Management, ID 9294. Can I have, no, that's just consent agenda, never mind. Government Operations Committee, Resolution B, authorizing the county administrator to sell real property located at 2422 North Triphammer Road, Ithaca, to FoodNet, ID 9281.
I'll move it.
Yep. Are you moving the whole consent agenda?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Deborah.
Second.
Seconded by Dave McKenna. Thank you very much. Roll call vote.
Mike Stigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Mooring?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Nippine Clairborn?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no.
All right, why don't we go ahead and take a quick 10-minute break? So we'll be back here. Well, it's more like a 12-minute break. Be back here at 7:40. Raring and ready to go. Thank you very much. We'll take a break. I'm trying to make sure that we have a quorum of people back. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yes, we are. Continuing the April 21st meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature, we're on to standing and special committee reports, beginning with Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. The Public Safety Committee met on April 16th. And we had a Zoom meeting. Most of the meeting was really talking about the public safety response to the COVID issue. The highlights of that, we talked with the sheriff and DA quite a bit about how they're managing cases. We also heard from Department of Emergency Response on overall call volume, which is down. We had some discussion about a slight variation in domestic violence calls or domestic dispute calls. They were up slightly in the call volume, even though the overall volume was lower. And obviously that's a concern with people staying at home and maybe getting on each other's nerves more than usual. This has certainly been something that the sheriff and the district attorney and emergency response have been paying very close attention to. After the meeting, the sheriff shared the procedure they have in place for responding to domestic dispute calls, and they look fully prepared in dealing with those. They coordinate with the Advocacy Center and other local agencies for assistance for people who are involved in domestic disputes, and that process seems to be up and running. We also started talking about the Labella report on the existing conditions at the jail. This is a very large discussion and will go on for some time. We anticipate having a presentation at our May meeting, which will be May 21st at 3 o'clock, and that will be live streamed as this meeting is for members of the public. The only other item from the meeting I wanted to mention is that one of the nurses at the jail, Nurse Goldsberry, has gone off to another job, and I wanted to commend her for her good work over a long period of time, particularly with medication-assisted treatment for people who are struggling with addiction problems coming into our jail. She really worked very hard and tirelessly on building up that program. So I wish her well. I have one resolution I'd like to put on the floor, and that's Resolution C, appropriation from Contingent Fund, Terminal Pay, Department of Probation, and Community Justice, ID 9225, and I move it.
Second?
Second.
Who was that?
Glenn.
Glenn, thank you, Glenn. Discussion? No? Roll call vote?
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grayson?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Callis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Anna Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Rick on his report? Martha? Then Henry?
Thanks, Leslie. This might be a Jason question, and I didn't get to it before during Jason's report. I had a couple of complaints from one constituent in particular about a non-essential gathering, and she went through over the weekend. She went through the NERC pause and calling 211 and calling and the other 833 phone number. And as she expected, by the time she, went through all of that, the party was over. So I did correspond with Derek, and he said, sort of went through several, emails about what the 911 center does in a case like that. And I said, you don't really want 911 to be called for a party. So and then it was unclear. He said, then people should call the non-emergency number for the sheriff's office. So I guess, can we get some clarity on that? On the website, it does send people. Now, for a business that's a non-essential business that's open where somebody is kind of filing a complaint, that makes more sense. There's a business that's open. So sort of accountable, you can find out, can check back with them the next day. But an individual who's got 6 or 8 cars out front of their house and people coming, they're going to be gone. So what exactly is the best thing for somebody to do?
Probably to call the non-emergency line. The non-emergency line at the sheriff's office, and then they can prioritize it based on the calls that they have. That's probably the best thing to do. calling 911 is not a good idea unless there's an emergent need for it. So I would say calling the non-emergent line at the sheriff's office is probably the best option. And then they can take the call and then respond how they would based on their call volume.
And could you remind us of the call and of the number, and then could that be put on the website, the health department website?
We can do that. I don't have it off the top of my head, but we can.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thanks a million.
Yeah.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you.
Now, unmuted now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to ask about the people at the jail and whether they are still virus-free or how things are going up there. Also, Dan asked a question last session about the people who are currently held in the jail. And I know Matt and Derek talked about it. I just wanted to recap what they said about letting people out.
Rich, you're still muted.
Sorry about that. Yeah, thank you, Henry. The jail population is as low as it's been in decades. We're running on the order of 28, maybe 29 inmates. And we did spend some time talking about that. Pretty much everybody there who's still being held is either serving a definite sentence or there's some significant reason why they cannot be held by some other method of supervision, such as an ankle bracelet or ankle monitor. The one issue is the people there on parole violations. And not to get too far in the weeds, but New York State runs the parole system, and that's for people who are getting out of prison. They get released into the community and they're supervised by a parole officer versus the county doing probation. We don't have any control over the parole officers, and they can violate somebody. They then get held in our local jail until a hearing to determine whether they should be sent back to state prison. Currently, we have, I believe, 7 or 8 people being held in our jail on parole violations, and these are... Some of them could be serious, but they also get violated for what are called technical violations, like missing a meeting or, you know, failing a drug test. So something that's not a crime and typically wouldn't put somebody in jail. The problem we have is that they're not taking them in the prison. And we had a hearing officer come down the week before last, and unfortunately didn't release anybody. So a good part of our jail population are parolees, roughly a quarter, and we have no control over that. And if they were in there for what they actually did wrong, we wouldn't be holding them. So this is a bit of a problem. With that said, the jail has been really careful on giving people space. They educate the inmates on why it's so important to maintain social distancing. They do have personal protective equipment that they use. And so far, they have had no inmates and no corrections officers seeming to be infected.
Okay.
Thank you. Deborah? Deborah, you're muted. We got you. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. This is in response to Martha's question. Martha, I don't know if you saw this email that Derek sent us this afternoon. It just says, in the event you are not aware, a hotline has been established to track and appropriately respond to complaints of large gatherings, social distancing related to COVID-19. If you receive complaints from constituents, or I guess constituents can do this themselves, please feel free to direct them to the New York State hotline at 1-833-789-0470. It also gives a website so you can complain online. And then it says complaints received are tracked and referred to the health department for triage, and if unsuccessful, referred to the appropriate law enforcement agency through our dispatch center. So maybe we can all just post that information on our Facebook pages and stuff so people know.
So I think that information we had gotten before, and I think what we just heard from Jason is also, you know, and Martha explained folks are having a little hard time getting through there, then the sheriff's office is offering the non-emergency number, and so we'll have all the information you mentioned, Deborah, as well as the non-emergency number for local folks if it's something like, you know, people are gathering for a party.
Oh, okay. Kind of thing. So, I thought perhaps he had sent this in response.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that.
Ronnie has the non-emergency number if you want it.
Yeah, 257-1345, I believe.
Well, what is it, honey?
On the bill.
Okay, can we? Okay, thanks, Rich. We'll just make sure we have the right number. It'll come out, and everybody will get it. Okay, Martha, you have your hand up for something else?
I was just to say that, yeah, that from message from Derek was in response to my question, but it didn't really answer the question, which is what happens to send something all the way to New York State and then have New York State vet it and then do what? Call somebody local?
Okay. So we get there. What we'll do is try and get the local emergency number. We'll work on that, but I think the state really wanted to get that stuff from folks as well. So we'll work our best around it based on what our county administrator, Sidney Hill, consults with our sheriff's department. All right. Anything else from you, Rich, or public safety?
No, that's it.
Martha's your hand still up, or did you have something else? Okay. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you very much. We actually had our meeting yesterday, and can I just say how nice it is to have a committee meeting a day before your legislature meeting? I haven't had that privilege before, but it bodes well for my memory. So we had a COVID-19 update from Jason and Frank. And then we had the COVID-19 Tompkins County Food Task Force, and Rachel Besner-Kerr and Anna Kellis came in to talk to us about the work that they're doing with the county. We also were emailed all of our department updates, and Kathy Covert sent that out to all of the legislators so that you're aware of what's going on with all of the departments that report to HHS. If there are any questions about those reports, feel free to let either myself know, or you can go directly to Jason or the department heads. We did have some appointments that Leslyn mentioned earlier tonight. And the one resolution that we have, I would like to move. It's Resolution 9312. Resolution calling on the state of New York to release enhanced federal Medicaid matching funds to counties in New York City.
Okay, thank you. Moved by Shauna, seconded by Amanda. Discussion?
Oh, yeah. I could talk a little bit to this. This was actually brought forth by Jason. Some of the other counties have also passed this resolution, and Martha also made some edits to that. So thank you, Martha. And essentially what we're doing is we're asking for our money back. There is a very large amount of money that New York State has been withholding for a very long time. There's currently discussion and debate over how much is actually owed to us. And so this is basically asking New York State to get their act together and give us back our money.
Thank you for your bravery, all of you. In the middle of a pandemic, you're going to tell the state to give us back our money. Yay. Other comments? All right, let's have a roll call vote. Oh, Anna, are you raising your hand?
Just as a comment after the resolution.
So, go ahead. You have a comment?
Yeah, no, just for clarification, the presentation on the emergency food system that we're putting together is not with the county as of yet. It's a community effort.
Oh, okay. All right, roll call vote.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Chuck Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie Bean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 no.
That passes unanimously. Thank you very much. Anything else for Shauna? Any other questions or comments? For HHS? No? Thank you very much. Moving on to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. Mike Lane, chairperson.
Yes, thank you. We met on April 16th. And talked about a lot of the different things in our departments. We've already seen the resolution on consent for the award of the testing for the groundwater at both the Hillview Road and Caswell Road landfills. I wanted to just make the point that we have an advisory committee called the Hillview Road Advisory Committee. That's been functioning since the early 1990s with respect to the Hillview Road closure and monitoring all these years, and I think also advising on Caswell. And I think we are very grateful to that committee. And some of the people on it have been there since the 1990s. I know Dan serves on it. Julie Kiefer served on it for a lot of years. What's Brian's last name, Dan? Yes, I'm sorry. It just slipped out of my head. From our longtime chair of our EMC serves on that, and we're very grateful to them, and we shouldn't forget about some of our lesser-known advisory boards and the good work they do for us. Barbara Ekstrom talked to us about the issue of the plastic bag ban at the state and what's happening now with the COVID-19 crisis. Among other things, there is a lawsuit going on that started really before the crisis about the plastic bags at the state level, and they aren't exactly sure what's going on with that. Barbara had inquired of the state DEC about it. You may notice that some of the retailers are using the plastic bags, even though they had been originally banned by the state. You go into Walmart, for example, and they're still using plastic bags because of the issue now having to do with the cleanliness of reusable bags. And the possibility of them having contaminants on them, including the COVID-19 virus. So some of the retailers don't want to have their cashiers, for example, using those bags at the present time. I was in Walmart this weekend, and they did put my objects in a plastic bag, and they charged me a nickel for it. So it's not only the plastic or the paper bags that are paying our nickel fee, but also right now the plastic, at least at that retailer. So we're keeping an eye on that. We hope it won't set us back too far on the road toward reusables, but we have to be aware of what's going on with COVID. Also, as far as the markets for recyclables, which have been pretty bad, as we all know, since China closed down the markets for a lot of the things that were shipped there. Barbara Ekstrom did tell us because of the shortage of certain paper goods like toilet paper and paper towels,
there is a much stronger price right now for paper goods and cardboard. So that's one good thing for our budget in that department. The highway department, Jeff Smith talked to us about the efforts to go ahead with normal construction as much as possible and yet stay safe and exercise good education efforts toward social distancing. For example, employees traveling in singly in trucks, for example, rather than multiple people in the same truck. And also he talked about a conference call he had done with the highway superintendents throughout the county, and talking about these kinds of safety issues and how they can coordinate them together for their employees. The state budget does have CHIPS money, consolidated highway improvement money, at the same level as last year. And it also has the bridge culvert effort or new round coming up, the Bridge New York program. However, all of that we know is in questionable flux because of the three opportunities that the state budget director has to cut back on funding that may be in the new budget. So it's nice that it's designated in the budget, but a budget is just that. It's the appropriations and the actual money that really counts. As far as the airport's concerned, we've got a resolution will be coming next time possibly, along with the bond resolutions possibly. That's a little in flux right now, too, because in the first stimulus package from the federal government, we believe there's approximately, I think, Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's $1.7 million coming to the airport. It may be usable for debt or bonding, but it can also be used for operations. So I know Jason and Mike Hall will be discussing what's the proper use of that money. A lot of us would like to see a reduction in debt that we have to borrow, but we also don't want to we also know that with the reduction in air traffic on the commercial side, that the operations may be affected. So we've asked them to talk and come back to us with a report at our next meeting. So those are some of the highlights of our meeting, and glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mike. Questions, Annie?
Thank you, and thank you for the report, Mike. So I just wanted to add that there was some press about it, but just to remind folks about the cardboard for recycling, that to please make sure you and advise other people if it comes up about putting your cardboard in a container so that it's less on hands handling of materials for the people that pick up the recycling.
Yes. And that's important, although I do wonder about large pieces. Sometimes it's not possible to fit them into the containers or that we have, the small covered containers or the bins that we have out there.
All right, Deborah?
Yeah, particularly now that we're, I think, probably ordering more stuff online and it's coming in those big boxes. We found that we can just flatten the boxes and put them all in one bigger one, and then they just have to pick up that one box and throw it in the truck.
All right. Good, perfect public service announcement there.
Good advice.
Very good. Thank you very much. Anything else, Mike?
I don't think so.
Thank you very much. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chairperson.
Yeah, thank you. The only thing I have to say is that our next meeting is on May 7th at 1:45 on Zoom. That's it.
All right. Thank you, Amanda. Any questions for Amanda or comments? No, thank you very much. Moving on. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, before I talk about our next meeting, I do have a resolution from our last meeting. It's Resolution D, authorizing a contract with Tompkins Soil and Water Conservation District to provide interim financial assistance to support conservation-related activities, ID 9221. This is something we pass every year. It fronts them money so that as they pass grant money through, if they have to pass something through before the grant comes, they've got some money to work with, and they pay us back at the end of the year. So I move that.
Second.
Thank you, Deborah. Second by Dave. Thank you, Dave, for that lovely voice seconding. Questions? Comments? Thank you. Roll call vote.
Mike Sigler?
Mike, we can't hear you. No, don't touch it.
There we go.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Horman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you for that. That carries unanimously. Other report from you, Deborah?
Yes. We're going to have another Lean Mean Peak meeting on the 28th via Zoom. We'll just be evaluating, I think, the upgrades to the ag districts in Tompkins County at that meeting. I do want to say, because it's Earth Day tomorrow and climate action is the theme, that I would ask that we all remember, even though we're in this urgent health crisis, that climate change isn't slowing down or stopping because we have a COVID-19 crisis, and it's still coming at us. I hope that we will not lose our commitment to mitigate it. As we move towards, you know, restarting our economy and looking for ways to push economic development in Tompkins County, I hope that we will focus on doing that in ways that support the transition to away from fossil fuels and to sustainable energy. And I look forward to working with AGD on these issues, and I hope that we can find a new normal that's economically sustainable and meets the goals of the CLCPA. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that, Deborah. Dan?
The meeting is May 27th, Monday.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Okay. I guess I would have been 24 hours late.
April 27th.
All right. Yes, Rich? That's not Memorial Day.
I just had a point of order that there is a trick with Zoom. If you hold down your space bar, you don't have to find your mute button or unmute button. You can unmute for a moment and say something and then drop it. As soon as you release the button, you're muted again. It's just a...
Oh, thanks. That worked.
Very good tool there, Rich. Thank you for that. It'll save us some time, too. All right. Everybody knows where your space bar is. Yay. Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Martha Robertson, Chairperson.
Thank you, Leslyn. We met on April 13th, had a robust discussion with Jason. But first, we were delighted that TC3 was present. Mike already reported on a lot of what they said, but Dr. Anthea Montague was with us, Deb Mollenhoff, and Bill Talbot. their interim finance CFO. They sounded in, I would say, a little bit better shape than I had expected. They had been able to say, I don't have the minutes from the meeting, but from memory, I think they have refunded board, room and board fees to the students who have left the campus. For the students who remain, they bulked up the food service to 21 meals a week. It had been, I guess, five or seven, so they're providing more meals to the students. And they actually felt relatively optimistic about next school year. As we know, they tend to do well in a recession, and this could be the mother of all recessions. So they are actually planning on enrollment will increase next year. So fingers crossed that the federal money that they are going to get will help them through, and a lot of adjustments that they're making are going to work out. As I said, we had a full discussion with Jason about all the question marks in the budget and the budget planning that he and Kevin and department heads are going through. We basically agreed we probably will need a second retreat, maybe in late June, so stay tuned on that. We did talk about some of the options. I mean, it looks like that they'll be planning sort of, you know, holding departments flat, and then perhaps looking at 5% or 10%, looking at different options that department heads would have to propose to structure their budgets. We've done that in the past, and looks like that's on the table this year. We do have our budget retreat next Tuesday, a week from tonight, 5:30, at the same Zoom channel, I guess. And it is expected that we'll need an executive session to discuss labor negotiations. So there were conversations, Jonathan and Jason and Kathy, about how to manage that. And so we will be holding it as an expanded budget committee meeting. So a little bit different than other retreats that we have done, but it will be a meeting, a formal meeting of the expanded budget committee. Kathy will send out an agenda. So that's how we'll participate, so that we can formally have an executive session after the main discussion. So basically, I think those are the main things. We did hear from Rick Snyder on residential energy and the sales tax on residential energy. He presented a lot of information that he pulled together, basically recommending that we leave it as is and not drop the sales tax on home heating. Committee agreed with that. And then we had two resolutions that have already been covered. So the next meeting is of budget, well, the executive committee, expanded budget next Tuesday night, 5:30. So if there are no questions, that's my report from budget.
Thank you, Martha. Questions, comments? Okay.
Thank you.
Moving on. Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Ann Corman, chairperson.
Thank you, Leslyn. So we have not met. We didn't meet last month, and we're not meeting again this month for the month of April. And but we, the vice chair, our vice chair, Henry Grandison, and I did reach out and had a conversation with Dr. Kenneth Clark today, the director of the Human Rights Office. And so he has been and is going to continue to reach out to various populations, such as our Asian community, Latinx, African American, and to see if there's any needs that aren't being met, to get information out, and so possibly a more formal report in a couple of weeks. Henry, and I'll just leave it up to Henry if you wanted to add anything else.
Yes. He said that he was meeting on every Thursday with the task force dealing with anti-Asian American discrimination. And
right.
He had no specifics yet, no numbers, but they are hearing from people who are facing discrimination every week.
Thank you. Any questions for Annie or Henry? No. Thank you. Moving on. Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslie. I guess the big news is that we sort of formalized ourselves as a committee and established a meeting date. We will be meeting the first Wednesday of the month at 11:30. So the next first meeting is going to be May 6th. There have been a lot of there's been a lot of activity even without a formal committee process or a meeting. A lot of folks have been on the calls, weekly calls with Tom Reed, and a couple of White House calls. There's a Reed call this coming Thursday at 1:30. I think everybody's gotten those. I got a notice about a White House call tomorrow at 11:30. I was wondering if anybody was planning to be on that. Any volunteers for that one? Okay. I'll continue to. Is everybody getting those? I don't want to bother passing those on if everybody's already getting them.
Yes. Great. Okay. I see it's nodding.
Which one exactly when you say getting them?
I think we're all getting Tom Reed's notices. The White House calls. I mean, I've gotten emails about, from a guy named Crozier.
They come from Crozier, who's their head of intergovernmental relations.
Right. We met him a couple of years ago back in D.C.
You cornered him.
If you're not getting it and you would like Martha to send it to you, please let her know.
Thank you. And we've had a lot of interaction with Amanda Spellacy from Chuck Schumer's office, with NYSAC. And thanks to Mike Sigler for reaching out to Tom Reed over the weekend as well, and basically about the federal bill. And I saw just on the news this evening that the new federal bill, $484 billion, has passed the Senate, and it's expected to go to the House on Thursday. So a lot of good stuff. Nothing for local or state governments. Although there's $25 billion for testing, and of that, $11 billion will go to states. But nothing directly to local governments at all. But apparently the White House has made a commitment that they would support funding for state and local governments in the next bill. However, the Senator McConnell has just said that he does not expect and wouldn't support doing more legislation without people coming back to Washington, and they're not back to Washington until May 4th at the earliest. So, Jason, hold your breath. We don't have anything very soon to look forward to. But maybe there's, you know, a future bolus of funding to help us, but we really can't plan on it yet. So thanks, everybody, for pitching in on those kind of calls and outreach. And stay tuned, and we'll meet on May 6th.
You're meeting May 6th, you said, Martha? At what time?
May 6th at 1:30.
At what?
I'm sorry, 11:30.
11:30.
Thanks, Kathy. Yes.
Henry, you have your hand up?
Yes, I do. There's a Institute of Politics meeting on Thursday, April 23rd, featuring Tom Reed and his Democratic chairperson, counterpart for the Problem Solvers Committee. And so I signed up. Anybody else wants to sign up? It's at the Institute of Politics at Cornell. It's starting at 12 noon. And you can hear me talk about things like this.
Thank you for sharing, Henry. Anything else, Martha?
No, that's Steve Israel is the head of that Institute of Cornell, and he's he has these periodic events, and those are really saying if any, I can pass those along to folks too if you're interested.
Please let Martha know if you would like that information. Again, do it offline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Housing Economic Development Committee meeting, Anna Kellis, chairperson. Anna, you're muted. I'm sure what you have to say is lovely, but we can't hear you.
Yeah, I tried to use the space bar thing, but you actually have to have the window open in a certain way to get it to work. So
we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Yep. So a couple updates. I wanted to let everyone know that the city and TCAD together created an economic recovery cabinet. It's meeting every other week, and it's a collective of economic development agencies, small businesses, large businesses, lending institutions, and others like the Chamber, DIA. Those would be the educational agencies. I will be attending those every other week and will give updates on those. It was brought up earlier in the city report, the Tompkins County City of Ithaca Small Business Resiliency Fund. That's the SBRF. So they had enough funding, I understand, for about 75 applications. Within 24 hours, they got about 140. I did want to bring it back up again just to highlight the extent of the need. I think it's really important that we're all aware of that. So they are seeking other funding right now, and we'll find out. Once I get word, I will certainly share it with everybody. I'm sure it will be covered in the news. So I figured I would just share that. The upcoming meeting, the HED meeting, is on this Thursday at 9:30 in the morning. And we will be covering, which, by the way, is the 23rd. I wanted to highlight a few things that we're going to be covering that are really important. One is updates on tourism and the room tax. They have been doing extensive interviews of all of the recipients, the previous recipients that have been applying regularly for tourism room tax dollars. And interviewing those who will not be getting funding, particularly in the grants that have been suspended. There are many that have been suspended for this year. The ACOD, Arts and Culture Organization grants, those were awarded prior to this pandemic. And extensive interviews have been done with them as well because of potential reduction in funding in the third and fourth quarter. So a discussion of the updated projection and the formula that was used for that, the scenarios that were identified, and a discussion of, you know, possible steps moving forward. The findings from all of those extensive interviews will not be presented this month because there's so much information to collate, so that will be ready by May. We're also going to get a presentation from Natalie from the Workforce Development Board. She is going to talk about the program they have put together to try and get people back into some jobs that actually are available in the area. As well as what is the current state and steps moving forward and plans moving forward for economic recovery in the context of labor. And finally, we're going to have a presentation from TCAD to talk about some of the loans that they've put in place. One of them is a bridge loan that has been put in place, microloan, and some of the other programs that TCAD has and steps TCAD has been taking in response to COVID. So as the committee that covers sort of economic development in the county, we're trying to give a broad brush stroke of what's happening. We also have some exciting potential news of something that we're hoping to pursue in the context of housing. So please do all attend who are interested, and that's my full report.
Thank you. Any questions for Anna? Henry?
Yes. I was wondering, I should have asked Duff this, but have you heard anything from the DIA or whatever about the conference center? Any new updates, anything that they're going to be doing?
The DIA just voted on a resolution on Monday. Confirming their commitment, which is the $50,000 a year for 10 years, which is $500,000 to be in a reserve fund, again, recognizing that the project won't start for another 3 years. So, you know, that is the buffer that both the city and the county, or the city and the DIA are working under. At the last Common Council meeting, Gary from the DIA and Jason, our Jason, and a few others presented. Jennifer Tavares was there, I think, also. Tom Knipe did an extensive presentation to the city that had many concerns. Those concerns seem to have been fully addressed at the time. There are some Common Council members that are still concerned, but as a whole, they did not bring a resolution forward to reverse their decision on supporting the conference center, again, in the context of the project starting several years from now. So both the DIA and the city, as of now, are still committed.
Thank you.
Do you have anything else to add to that? Because you gave a presentation and answered questions.
You captured it.
Thank you. Was that it, Henry?
And that Common Council meeting was, what, April, like early April?
Correct. First week in April. First Wednesday.
All right. Anything else, Anna? Thank you. Thanks, Anna. Complete Census Committee. Census Count Committee. Mike Lynn, chairperson.
Thank you. We have not had a meeting since our last legislature meeting, but there's been a lot of activity, of course. Public Information Advisory Board has been working very hard at trying to get the word out about the need for people to be counted in the census, particularly with the issue of the students. We have been stymied by not having the state funding that was promised. That seems to still be in limbo. I talked with Nick Murphy very recently, and he said that they don't have any additional information on when and if that money will be coming out of the state. That was about $130,000 that we were hoping to get toward this census effort. Thanks to Henry Granison, who has kept us informed of a lot of things, a couple of things recently. Henry, you sent an email out today, and thank you, about trying to have legislators continue to get the word out on their listservs and other community connections that they have. And, Henry, I liked the fact that you sent us that article about, from the Cornell Daily Sun, about the sad response we're getting in the college town area from particularly the graduate students and those living in apartments that meant many of them have gone home. But I think it was, what, 18% was only at this point. We were 40% countywide, but once again, that area is severely undercounted, and that was one of the prime undercounted areas in the 2010 census. So we need to double our efforts there. Kate Supron, leading the effort at Cornell University, has been working, sending out information to the students, trying to get them to understand that they need to, when they do the census, first of all, they have to do the census, and second, they need to indicate that they are living in Tompkins County and not where they are going back at home. Back home for this pause that we have based on the COVID-19. The ones in the dorms are not the problem. It's the ones that live in private apartments, privately owned fraternities and sororities, and folks that often think of themselves as independent and not necessarily living in Ithaca or Tompkins County. So if you know people, continue to get your word out. It's pretty important.
Thank you, Mike. Henry, do you have your hand up? Question, comment?
Yeah, I was wondering what's happening with the census workers who are hired to go out and walk the streets.
Well, of course, the whole census is up in the air as to when that was supposed to happen, and a lot of the folks can't really go door to door because of the issues of whether they'll be let in or whether they want to work where they might be exposed to the virus, for example. And the whole census thing may be pushed back 120 days. It could be pushed back till the end of the year. All of that is still in play. We don't have a decision on any of that yet from the federal government, but it plays on us locally, as Amanda will probably tell you, because it could affect our redistricting discussions that we're having now. So that's the best way I can answer you, Henry.
Thanks, Mike. Ann?
Thank you. Just in a little more information of what I've heard regarding Henry's question is the people that I've been in contact with that did sign up and were actually starting to work or preparing to work, getting either going door to door or going to apartments or whatever, they were instructed some weeks back to cease working.
All right. Thank you for the update. Martha?
Yes, Mike, what's your sense about the delay? I hate to say out loud in public that it's hard to trust what the president says is a good idea. So I don't. Please understand how I mean that. That
question.
The question is, the president, I understand, has asked for for this to be delayed, I don't know, 3 months, whatever. Do the census people think that's a good idea? Is that the right thing? What do you think?
At least from the information that I've read, and I don't really have a lot of firsthand knowledge any more than any of us does, but I think that because there are so many parts to a nationwide census effort that have been, you know, they've been planning this for 10 years as to how they were going to go ahead. And now to have to change all that, all the contracts that are involved, all the employees that they're hiring, all of the data they were expecting and when it was coming, and the follow-up and all of that, I'm sure at the national level they are they're going through quite a lot just to try to figure out what they can do and how long it can be delayed. 120 days is the one figure I've heard the most, but I guess your guess is as good as mine, Martha.
Okay, I wasn't sure. It seems to me it's such a train wreck of all things to be doing in the middle of a pandemic. But the online and, you know, the phone, it's accessible by phone, it's accessible online. Thanks. Those systems are set up, so I hope we can still, like, improve the data gathering in the meantime. So thanks for the effort.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Amanda?
Yeah, I was just going to answer that. I've read an article that the Census Bureau itself is actually asking for a four-month extension, and they've pushed field operations and everything else back. And it's not the president's decision, it's actually Congress. So the president can say what he wants, but it's really Congress that has to make the decision. And the other thing I read was that they were also asking for an extension for when they would, not just their operations, but when they would get the data both to the president and to municipalities, either the end of the year or next spring. So, you know, like this sort of process. So I think that my understanding is that the Census Bureau wants more time.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Anna?
Yeah, just a question about the offices, the regional offices. My understanding is that it was slated to open up April 15th, but it did not, if I recall hearing correctly, and I just wanted to confirm that. I spoke to a couple of the people, the census workers, and with the office closed, they're doing sort of the process of interviewing people who are applying for those census jobs, because my understanding is there are still a lot of need for census workers. But they can't complete that process fully until that office is open. They can't onboard, even though they're going through a majority of the sort of process of selecting and then giving them paperwork and doing, they can go to a place because it's a central facility. They can get fingerprinted for their background, but they can't do that final step. Is that Is that all accurate? We can't get new workers until the office is open?
Well, I think some of them have been taking training in Syracuse, but they're not a local office, if that's what you mean, Anna.
Okay.
Thank you. I can follow up offline.
All right. Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Martha. Anything else on census? Okay. Thank you all. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, chairperson.
Thank you. This is an easy one. We have not met. Don't know when we will meet for sure. So that's my report.
Thank you, Dave. Any questions for Dave? No. All right. We are done with our standing committees. We have an individual member filed resolution. Henry Granison.
Yes, I'd like to move that the resolution to urge New York legislature to suspend rent payments for certain tenants and certain mortgage payments for certain landlords for 9 days in response to the outbreak of COVID-19 by passing Senate Bill S-8125A and Assembly Bill A-1022-224A, document 9302. I move it.
Henry moves it, seconded by Deborah.
Okay. And
comments. Henry, were you saying something else?
Yes. I was basically saying that I'm introducing this memorandum in support of renters. We know that Ithaca has about 75% rental properties in the city of Ithaca, at least, and that, you know, this coronavirus has hit them very tough, very hard, and that and this is just sort of a way to support them because they haven't been supported by federal government either in 2008 or even 2020. I know during the times when Tom Reed has had his conversation, Savante Myrick has often brought this issue up, and Tom Reed says, yes, that's very nice. But he doesn't really have anything for them. Also, there was an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and it said, and I quote, a staggering 40% of renters spend more than a third of their rental income on rent, while a quarter of renters give more than half of their income to their landlord. Also, according to estimates from the Survey of Household Economics and Decision-Making, 57% of renters could not afford an unexpected increase of $400 with the money that they have on hand. These households, any loss of income is a threat to housing stability. And so that's why I brought it. That's why this was passed by the Common Council during their most recent meeting and unanimously. It was also passed by the Seattle City Council and the Boston City Council. I think the issues are pretty much laid out. I know it's a significant ask for people to support this legislation, but I hope they will. I'm done.
All right. Thank you, Henry. Anna Kellis.
So just to give people an update on the various resolutions or various bills that are at the state level, 8125 is one of the bills that was brought forward, as was 8139 and 8140. 8125, which is the bill that is identified in this resolution, has actually been deemed unconstitutional and does not have support and will not be moving forward. The reason is because it essentially would set up a situation of eminent domain.
Yes.
Because you would be the government would be enforcing non-payment to essentially, in this context, the banks. So first the landlords and then the banks. So there isn't movement forward on this particular resolution. That's why I've been working on 8140. That is the one that Vocal, Make the Road, Citizen Action, They have all endorsed 8140 because it is, instead of a situation that's unconstitutional, it creates an emergency rental assistance program in the form of emergency vouchers for eligible individuals and families, which is not deemed unconstitutional. So I really think that it would have been better to go through committee on this and allowed the committee to work together. And I suggest that if we are interested as a group, we should focus on the bill that is still has active support and support by agencies and has a chance of potentially getting funded. Of course, it would require the state to put funding into these emergency vouchers, but it puts that on the state, recognizing, you know, the statewide need for relief for renters.
Thank you. Amanda, did I see your hand up? Okay. Mike Lane or Mike Sigler, I see you.
I'd like to move to refer this resolution to the Housing Committee.
Okay. Move on the floor to send this to the Housing Committee, seconded by Mike Sigler. Comments? Dan Klein.
So what Anna just said, that this bill is no longer viable in the legislature, and that's news to me. Henry, I'm not sure if it's news to you. I'd like to hear how you would respond to that. That would help me make my decision about whether to send this bill back, this resolution back to committee or not.
Yeah, it also is news to me that it's been held unconstitutional. But again, I think the you know, just the sense of the legislature is important to say that we support renters, whether it's illegal. I know that the estimates are that maybe 50% of the people are not going to be able to pay their rent on May 1st. And so I think it's a symbolic move that we would support this, even if it's been deemed unconstitutional, that we support renters in this way. But
Mike Lane?
Well, I know we all support tenants, but, you know, we also have to support landlords. There are an awful lot of landlords. I've represented many of them in my legal practice over the years. Small people that, not small people, but small landlords that maybe have a duplex and rent the apartment in order to help them pay the taxes on the house, or, you know, one or two small apartment houses with two or three apartments in them. When we think of landlords at the state level, we think of New York City, we're thinking of these high-rise skyscraper apartment complexes with huge, huge incomes. In Tompkins County, that's not always the case.
Thank you. Mike Sigler. I see you, Deborah. I see you, Amanda.
All right, for some reason that didn't work. Sorry about that. Listen, I wrote a pretty long email to you all. I hope you all got it. I think you did. I'm just going to ask that be entered into the record. I don't want to go through the whole thing again. I mean, I gave you some personal experience about it. Just touch on a couple things. Listen, I'm a landlord. I don't want my tenants to be out on the street, obviously. And I don't want to look for new tenants at this period of time. I mean, that would be foolish. You're in the middle of a pandemic. So I'm going to work with my tenants. They're going to work with me. I really see this as not only unnecessary. I'll go into the legal part later. I'm actually surprised this is kind of being put forward in a legal context. But it's listen, if you're a landlord, it's a service like any other service. I mean, a lot of you have jobs. If you went to work and somebody couldn't pay you, would you say, well, you know, I don't ever expect to get paid for that work? No, you'd say, okay, listen, I can float you for a while. I can float you for a couple months. I can defer the payment. But eventually, I would think you'd want to be paid for that service. Maybe not. Maybe you would forgive it. But that would be up to you and up to the person. And for the county to come in here and say, we're going to interfere in a contract, I don't see how we could support that. I mean, we make contracts as a county with other people. Are we just going to say someday, well, we're not going to, you know, we don't like that contract we signed with you, so we're just not going to, things haven't turned out as we like, so we're not going to pay you for that. I don't know. I see real problems with this all the way around. So, frankly, I like the way that I worked it out with my tenants. That was my responsibility, and that was my tenants' responsibilities, and we both, as two sides, took that seriously. I don't think you actually need the government to come in and weigh in on this, because the government already has weighed in on it. They've already given the no eviction. They've already given the 90 days. And the banks, frankly, have worked with landlords pretty well and with mortgage companies pretty well. I mean, I've got a deferment on the one mortgage for the rental property, which gave me room to work with the tenants. So anyway, like I said, I wrote a pretty long thing. Please enter that into the record, Kathy, and that's all I have to say for right now. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike Seacrest. Amanda Champion, followed by Anna Kellis, then Deborah Dawson. I see you, Anne.
I guess I was just wondering what it would look like for Henry and Anna to take this back to committee. Like, I don't know all the work that Anna's put in, and I just wonder if Henry is willing to do that and look at the bigger picture and whatever other resolutions are available.
Are you asking a question, or are you?
Yeah, I'm asking if they are willing to do that, and I don't know. I think Anna said the next HED meeting is coming up really fast. Is it on your agenda? Could it be on your agenda?
So this is a member filed resolution by Henry, and the motion on the floor is to refer it back to a committee,
right.
This time the HED committee, which meets on Thursday, right, Anna?
Next Thursday.
I'm happy to
answer. Right. So at our last meeting, we referred Anna's resolution back to committee. So my guess is that it might be on that. I don't know. I'm asking.
Yeah, that was a different resolution that was brought forward. The 80, the one that is currently being promoted, the state 8140. I have a draft that once I saw a Henry's member filed, I have reached out to the coalitions. And I'm happy to bring forward the 8140. And the reason why that is the one, and two things. One, I am happy to forward documentation of the unconstitutionality of the 8125 so that everybody has that. And the 8140 addresses to some extent Mike Sigler's concern, because it is an emergency voucher program. Those vouchers would go directly to the landlords. So it does address that. And it also addresses concerns that Mike Lane has brought forward previously. So, yeah, I would be happy to finish putting that together and put that into to the HED agenda if that interests people. Again, supporting our tenants in this county, given the strain, I think that would be a benefit for all of us if the state moved forward with that.
So, Anna, the resolution on the floor is Henry's resolution, and the motion was to refer that back to committee. So,
and I would then put forward, if this was put back to committee, in committee, I would put forward a resolution that would substitute.
Okay.
Yes, I don't really see this being referred to committee. I mean, if it is unconstitutional, which I can't find anything about it, but I welcome Anna to send it to us. That, you know, it's very clear. It's like, okay, we want to suspend rental payments. It doesn't really have much negotiation there. It's a very short bill, as I sent it to you earlier. And so sending it back to committee doesn't really make sense to me. In fact, it's a different bill than the ones Anne is talking about. It goes much further than the ones she's talking about. And in fact, you know, it was introduced into Congress by Representative Omar, at least a version of this, on April 16th. I assume that's also eminent domain. I assume that the Seattle one was held unconstitutional. I assume the Boston one, in theory, was held unconstitutional. But I haven't heard any of those things. And so I'm willing to work with Anna, but I don't see there's anything to work on with. That, you know, there's nothing really there.
All All right, so I see a lot of hands to speak, but the motion on the floor is to refer this back to committee. Are you trying to speak to that, or can we take it to a vote? Okay, Deborah, you're up.
Well, yeah, thank you, Leslyn. I was all set to vote for this because I really like the law that this would support. But as much as I want to support tenants, I think I would remind us that we all took an oath to support the Constitution, federal and state. Until we get this thing nailed down about whether or not this thing is constitutional or not, I can't vote for it. And that's, to me, a good enough reason to send it to committee and figure out exactly what the situation is with the constitutionality of the various statutes.
All right. Thank you, Deborah. Ann Corman, and then Martha Robertson.
Thank you. So overall, I like the idea, of course, of helping out tenants who are in need. So my issues with it is that all tenants aren't in need. I realize that probably we have a large percentage of our population in the county who may be in need of this. But looking at who's going to be paying for this, myself, I was a landlord, and 10 to 20% is, if you're lucky in a given year, is what you have after you pay all your bills. So I would rather support something that had some type of voucher based on need, and that some type of somebody was paying for this besides just the landlords.
Thank you, Martha.
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed on this. That might surprise people, but I would since HED meets in 2 days, and Annie said we could bring this. To that agenda. As a practical matter, the state legislature is not in session. So putting this to a committee and then bringing something back in two weeks from now, I wouldn't delay any action unless this would stimulate an executive order, I guess. But so I would be in favor of moving this to a committee.
Okay. Thank you. Shauna?
Yeah, I'm not sure, from my understanding, why this would make sense necessarily to move to a committee. It sounds like Henry wants this to move forward. And, you know, if that's the case, then we should just, you know, vote on it as is, you know, with the understanding that Anna will also be bringing something forward out of committee. You know, Henry, I think the idea is if it moves to committee, you could get more support. Perhaps you can combine efforts with Anna and present a whole new resolution. But I don't hear that collaboration on your end. And so, you know, my thought is nothing's going to come to it if it goes back to committee. So why not vote on it now?
Thank you for that. So the motion on the floor is to send this resolution to committee, which would be the HED committee. I'm going to call for a vote. Roll call vote.
Mike Sigler.
Hold on. Yes, to committee.
Shauna Black.
No, to committee.
Amanda Champion.
No.
Deborah Dawson.
Deborah
Johnson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
No.
Dan Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
No.
9 ayes, 5 noes.
Okay, so it is moving on to committee. Thank you very much for that, and I look forward to see what comes out of HED. Okay, moving on to the minutes of our previous meeting. May I have someone move the minutes, please? Moved by Ann Corman, seconded by Mike Sigler. Discussion on the minutes. Any changes? Yes, Martha?
Yes, since we asked for changes, I sent a couple of things to Kathy, and she said they were fine. They're sort of elaborations on things I'd said. So if you want, I can read them, Kathy.
Sure, if you want to.
Are
any of them real,
no.
Large? Kathy said they're not, so
they're fine.
They're not, you know, any substantive that's going to change the minutes at all, so thank you. No need to read them. Anything else in the minutes? Roll call vote. All in favor of the minutes? Go down the line.
Stigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
The minutes of April 7th have been moved unanimously. Any unfinished business? No? Thank you all. It's good to see your lovely faces. Motion to adjourn. Moved by Mike Sigler. Seconded by a bunch of people waving. Seconded by Ann Corman. Do I have to go down a roll call vote again?
No.
Okay. Everybody is in favor, unanimous for adjournment. Have a good evening. Thank you very much. Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Jason, Jonathan, Beth. Beth stayed through our entire meeting. Wow.
Thank you, Leslie.
Take care, everyone.